I think it's a little after 9 a.m.
9:20.
It's approximately 9:20 in the morning on March 17th. And we're here at the headquarters of the OCC in Washington. It's Bart DeZeeve and Scott Gans from the FCIC. And if we could have the participants from the OCC identify themselves for the record.
Linda Bridgman.
Snowwater House.
Erica Unsager.
Richard Stearns.
And we're here today to interview. Interview Mr. Waterhouse. So I'll just read you this little format we have at the beginning of these interviews. We try to have a standardized procedure among all the different folks who are doing interviews for the FCI. So we're here to interview you today about Citibank and Citigroup. This interview is being recorded. It's on behalf of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Don't know how much you know about that. We have 10 commissioners, bipartisan panel appointed by Congress. We have to prepare a report to the President and Congress by December 15th, 2010, and this interview is part of that process, as are public hearings that we have. You folks probably know, Title 18, Section 1001 covers making false statements to federal officials. It's the same thing that covers you and your work, covers us and our work, and is applicable to today. If you ever need a break, just let us know. I'm sure you've talked to the folks here. We're happy to take a break anytime you want. I expect this interview will go approximately 4 hours or so. If you have any questions about my questions, if they don't help clarify them, just ask me. And more importantly, if I have to ask a question and you answer it, but you think there's really a better question, go ahead and ask yourself the question and answer it, because this is an educational process for us. And we're trying to find out as much as we can in a very short time frame. And you've lived this experience, and we're just sort of diving in on a shallow basis. So we know we don't know as much as you do. So anything you can add to help us with our task would be appreciated. So let's start with some of the basics. How long have you been at the OCC?
I've been over 25 years. Can I...
Sure.
Less than 30, over 25. I don't know, somewhere in that range.
Okay.
Born and raised as an examiner in San Francisco.
Oh, great.
Spent about 7 years in London, and I've had a couple tours of duty here in New York. First tour was as the Ron Frake of Citibank in the mid-90s. So I was a team leader for capital markets. I then came back as the examiner in charge in 2002. Came back from London, and more recently I moved over to J.P. Morgan Chase.
And if my recollection is right, Mr. Lyons became EIC in October 2007. Yes. So that's when you.
Yeah, that's when he and I passed the baton, in effect. But you know, there was a bit of track where we both were holding on to the baton. So.
So how long was that overlap? How?
I was there with John actually for quite a while at the Citibank site.
Right.
But part of my work morphed over into this senior supervisors group activities. So while I was there, I was spending a disproportionate amount of time on the SSG stuff as we're going around and interviewing different firms. So I think technically the overlap would have been about 3 months we were trying. So the third and into the fourth quarter would have been, I would say, the overlap. Because I think it was August when he was announced. He started coming over, and then we rolled in through the end of the, probably the end of the fourth quarter, not quite, but you know, in that
so range. Sort of calendar year end-ish.
Yes.
All right. Why don't you give me some context about what the EIC position is? If my understanding is correct, it's sort of the central point of contact with the insured depository institution. Would you just say that's accurate?
I would phrase it slightly different because the central point of contact denotes the Fed. They use a central point of contact, and that role is different than what the EIC role is.
Okay.
So I am the examiner responsible for the bank, all bank supervision activities. Listen here. I am responsible for building a team of examiners and then designing a supervisory strategy to analyze and assess and rate the risks and execute the strategy through the team. At Citi, we had seven or eight team leaders, and I'd have to count them up.
Right.
But we had a team that largely interfaced with the way the bank did business, but also recognizing that we do supervision by risk. So it's kind of this amorphous program where we have risk responsibilities and line of business responsibilities. The risk kind of dominates on it. So we'd have somebody who would be responsible for credit risk,
right,
who would look at corporate credit, but we'd also have somebody on retail side that would look at credit risk. So we'd have to pull that together. So anyway, we'd design a supervisory strategy that would focus on the high risk or the moderate risk areas or those areas where there's management concerns, and then we'd develop a strategy that would have a program of examinations during the course of the year, a program of ongoing supervision where we would engage management to try to understand and dimension the risks, and then communicate with bank management our findings. We have supervisory letters that we would issue to the bank at the end of each examination or as part of our ongoing supervision. There are times when we would issue letters that we would feel would be necessary. And at year end, as you know, we would roll that together into a report of exam where we would summarize all of our thoughts on the CAMHAS ratings and the risk assessments, highlight matters requiring attention and things that would deserve board level attention. So the way the OCC works, which I think is different than the Fed, is that it is my responsibility for all the ratings, all the assessments. I would talk to Grace Daly, is my deputy controller. She was there. She is again. I would talk to her regularly, one time a day, two times a day, sometimes three times a day, quite a bit. In all cases, I never remember her ever overruling me on any of my risk assessments or my CAMHAS ratings. Those were my call. So I was responsible for the bank.
And generally, a lot of correspondence goes out under your signature, but I assume that those aren't just your thoughts, that those represent
correct
things that other people in the OCC have, you know, sometimes folks below you have done the work putting together the stuff. Sometimes people above you have policy decisions. So just because a letter goes out from your signature, it obviously incorporates your stuff, but you may not have been the principal author or the principal director of that letter.
Correct. The letters are, and you will see over time, when I first was the EIC, we have these team leaders who are fairly senior in the OCC with a lot of responsibility and a lot of skills and expertise in their respective areas. When I started at Citi as EIC, I would have them sign the supervisory letters. Actually, what would happen would be they would write a conclusion memo summarizing their work.
Right.
And then we put a cover letter on it and share it with bank management as a courtesy. This is what we found. And I would have the team leader sign those. About midway through my term at Citi, large banks made a determination that they wanted the EICs to sign everything, so I became the signature on everything. But yes, the work is done by the guys who know what they're doing, the guys who are deeply involved in the activities. It's drafted by probably an examiner that is below the team leader. It goes to the team leader for quality control assessment, thinking about how the risks are positioned and how they are relative. And then after the team leader would go through it, then it would come to me, and then I would look at it from a more broader perspective, do my edits, and then send it out. There are occasions when policy or legal would provide input to our supervision. More often, it would be our risk analysis division, which we call them RAD, R-A-D.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the quantitative guys that we use to help out on the technical aspects of the examinations. They get into the models.
Right.
They get into the black box. I'm not qualified to
do that. Those big binders I saw when I was in New York, those are the guys who have to read the stuff in those binders.
And tell us what's in it. So, but yeah, RAD is probably the primary external constituent that we would use in our supervision. Legal, we would use on a periodic basis. We may talk about an instance later on in your pile. But where we need a legal opinion, where we need a legal input, new products is one where we frequently would use legal input. And then policy will often interject interpretations of policy or new standards. But when policy does that, they typically would not write anything for the supervisor letter. And indeed, with each of those instances, they would provide input to the supervisory process. It would go through that same machine where the team leader would review it, edit it, and then come back to me. So it still comes. The pen is really the EFC and the team leaders.
And my understanding is, at least with the current comptroller, that you brief him perhaps twice a year on a regular basis on the whatever the large bank is that you're currently assigned to. Is that correct?
There is an annual meeting that we have with Mr. Dugan where we provide a briefing document and all that for him. And then I go over to the FDIC and brief them as well at the back end of that. But Mr. Dugan's very interested in the banks, and he will meet with the executive management at times. And whenever he does that, he expects to have a briefing document to support that. And if there are items of interest or risks or issues that would issues du jour, he may ask for. So the others would be ad hoc. I would say there's an annual requirement, and then there are ad hoc things depending on what Mr. Dugan would like.
So, for example, in November 2007, that was sort of right in the middle of the transition period. But it was also in the early part of November 2007 when the disclosures were made about the losses on the super senior CDOs. Do you recall, did you have any of these ad hoc briefings with the comptroller in that period?
I had one that leaps to mind, and that was the initial disclosure that the bank was going to make with respect to these losses. We had a phone call with Senior Risk Officer Bushnell and General Counsel Helfer, Bushnell and Helfer, and Dugan. I'm not sure who else. I'm sure Grace would have been on it. I was there. I think John Lyons was there. So we had a conference, but this is late in the day, early in the evening, where the bank explained what was coming. What was interesting is that the bank told us that we were going to take some losses on these positions. And we asked them how much, and they didn't want to tell us.
Really?
And so it came back that we said, well, we're your regulator. We would really like to know. So we arranged the conference call. So we had this call. And they walked through, and I don't remember the details, they walked through what they were going to take. In fact, I don't even remember how big it was, but it was in the early stages, so it was one of the lesser of the big hits.
Right.
And I remember in that call, at the end of that, asking Dave Bushnell, where are these losses? What legal entity? And he goes, Scott, they're all in the bank. So we hang up. And immediately Mr. Dugan calls me up and he says, what the heck are you told me it wasn't in the bank. And I said, it's not in the bank. So we had this back and forth that it turns out that subsequently it was determined, and I don't know where, you know, I don't have the information in front of me, that it wasn't on the bank.
Right.
And I think that is an indication of kind of how the bank thought about the risks. They weren't ever clear on where they were. Many of these things were outside of the bank. Some of them were in the bank, but they didn't think about it that way.
Right. Do you recall if this telephone conversation was before or after the, November 4th, 2007, where there was a management change where Chuck Prince resigned?
And I believe that was before, I believe.
So the phone call was before
this? Yeah.
Okay.
I think, I don't want to go too far with
that,
because there was financial statement disclosures coming out. And I think my recollection is that it would have been in that time frame of the financial disclosures. And I believe Chuck Prince resigned after that.
Right. And were you in New York, I take it? And so it was like a three-way conference call, OCC here, you in New York, and city guys in New York.
Correct.
Do you have an administrative assistant who keeps your calendar, or do you use Outlook, or how do you...
I use Outlook, and my administrative assistant, I do not let touch my Outlook. My new one I do. My old one I did not.
Yeah.
And
if you're looking for the date of that call, I'm sure we can get that for you.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, like, my computer's crashed a couple times. I just changed it over, and I went back and looked for dates.
Well, we can...
And
I mean, there's an easy way here.
Yeah, good.
Get that information for you today.
Okay. You've got somebody who can do it. I don't know that I can do that.
Well, there were several people on the call.
Yes.
And I'm sure pinned down the date and the time.
My hard drive has crashed three times since I've been with the FCI since October, so that's why I let other people touch all the electronic stuff. I think I'm jinxed. So what I'm going to do today is sort of go roughly chronologically through some documents, but I'm going to try and sort of stick to piles, and so I'm going to go through sort of the documents I interviewed Mr. Frank with first, and then I've got some other documents. So it'll be chronologically, but then we'll be hopping out of sequence into other piles and then chronologically within that pile. Just so I can try and keep these straight. That's one of my challenges. So there's a process called the Capital Markets Approval Committee process. What can you tell me generically about what your understanding is?
I just want to make clear, these types of questions, you're going to be asking him for the time period in which he was EIC,
right.
not his understanding of how things work today or
right.
in the previous period.
Right.
Just to put a context on it.
Sure. This CMAC.
Right.
Was originally designed to talk to kind of the market risks of new businesses, and that was early in the 2000s and maybe before. Over time, it evolved. After Enron, it evolved into a broader committee that would deal with more of the business issues that would relate to new products than it originally had. So it basically is the vehicle whereby new products are brought to it, and it would render an opinion of whether it is an appropriate product for the bank to engage or the group to engage in as a product in the bank.
And before the formal agreement was lifted at the end of 2006, I believe, can you explain to me the difference between what PCAG did and what CMAC did?
Sure. PCAG is part of audit. And so audit would perform its role in as an independent assessment of the what CMAC and what the business would be doing. So they had their own quantitative individuals in there. So I'm almost certain. I've got to put one little bit of hesitation there, because I'm almost certain that's what the PCAG was. So, and it was part of audit.
Okay. So the first document I have here is Frake 1, and why don't you just take a look at the cover.
Right.
And let me know if this looks familiar, if you think you've ever seen a document before.
Did Frank punt this one to me? If he did, I'll have a conversation with him. So. But this is going back, obviously, in 2002. This would be a typical, and this GCIB is Global Corporate Investment Bank, right? Capital Markets Approval Committee package. So I am only familiar in generic terms about this and the processes. So I don't know the document.
Okay.
I don't know the product.
Okay. So when we were up in New York going through the work papers to the exams, we found this. And I don't know, and I can't say for sure, but of the documents we found, this was the first reference to a liquidity put product. What can you tell me about when you first became aware of a liquidity put product being utilized at Citibank or Citigroup?
I was not aware of it until they were exercised.
So that, my understanding is they, beginning in August of 07, Citibank actually began to buy commercial paper back from the entity rather than allowing the put to be exercised. Is that not your understanding?
That's kind of a double negative there. Can you rephrase your question?
What is your understanding of what happened in August 2007 with respect to the liquidity puts? Were they exercised by the person who had the put option, or did Citibank purchase the commercial paper? If you have an understanding, recollection.
As you say that, it triggers a memory, honestly, because I know the puts were exercised, but there may have been, I don't know for sure, but there may have been a time when Citi was actually buying the CP in lieu of exercising the puts. But I don't know for certain. I think that's probably true.
Okay, that's fine. So when you became aware of it, was it in August 2007 or was it in November 2007 when the losses started?
It would have been later.
It would have been the November period.
Yeah.
So you agree with what he just said, which was the losses started in November?
No, the losses were, I became aware of the put later on, but the losses occurred at about the time this phone call occurred, which would have been earlier. Do we mix messages on that?
Okay, so when did the phone call might have been in October?
The phone call was, I believe, in October, would have been earlier, and then the details of it became known after that.
Okay.
So in other words, we would have heard that they're taking write-downs on certain super senior positions and other positions, but the nature on how they would have gotten there via purchasing commercial paper or via exercising the put, I was not clear at that time.
Okay.
Thanks.
Next, I'd like to go to Frake 7. It's a memo to file from Bruce Johnson, dated September 27, 2004. And it's a meeting with various Citibank, Citigroup officials regarding a formal agreement. Do you know if you've ever seen this document before?
I don't recall this document.
Okay. Who is Bruce Johnson?
Bruce was one of my team leaders, former examiner in charge of another large bank. One of them. But he was brought in as a team leader responsible, and I charged him with basically the formal agreement, determining compliance with the formal agreement.
So did that have like a separate team?
He had a couple people, and I think you have a Jahan Lipinski memo later on. Jahan reported into him, and another individual reported. So I think he had two, Paul Edgington, reported into him.
Okay. Can you take a look at the second page of this? There's concerns, paragraph one. Can you just take a minute and read paragraph one?
Right. I read this.
So did Mr. Johnson ever, in his conversations with you as the team leader talking to EIC, did he ever describe to you his sort of general theory that's set forth here, that there's kind of a slow increasing of risk in the products being presented, the so-called boiling frog theory, that if you put a frog in hot water and gently warm it up to the point of boiling, the frog just sort of sits there until it's cooked?
You know, I don't remember a specific conversation with Bruce over that, but I interpret this differently.
Okay.
I interpret this, and this would be more consistent with my discussions with Bruce, because he's talking about the concern over the boiling frog, as he says in the second line there, says they may become too conditioned and not perceived. So I think what Bruce is doing is exercising an air of caution to the bank that as they design and think about, what was this? They design and think about the composition of the committee, it's important to recognize that this type of stuff can happen. And so I kind of interpret it that way, that it's not a concern that currently exists, but that it's something that they ought to watch out for. Let me read it again. May become too conditioned and not perceived. Occasionally sending the most extreme deals.
Could you read the sentence out loud?
Sure, let me start. Relativity and the boiling frog theory. It's always good to get that on the record, right? I explained that I was concerned that management and committees such as CMAC, which are too close to these types of products, may become too conditioned and not perceive subtle changes over a long period of time, much like what happened in the real estate lending in the 1980s. I explained that occasionally sending the most extreme deals to Bushnell and Randy Farmer was a good practice and helped them occasionally dip their fingers into the pot and to ensure the water was not getting too hot. If they were involved with every deal, they too may have become conditioned and lose objectivity. The BPC, Business Practice Committee, may also become a control point for this risk since they do not see every deal, but only those furthest on the edge. However, this is still a risk which they will need to watch carefully. So I'm thinking that that's, and as Bruce and I discussed this stuff, and we talked about the composition of the CMAC committee, I think it's more a cautionary thing. I don't, because we never took issue that the CMAC was inappropriately staffed or that it was too, it was not doing, or that, yeah, that it didn't have the right membership. I don't recall that that actually surfaced.
Okay. Let's go on to a document that is FRAIC number 8. It's a June 13, 2005 letter to the Board of Directors of Citibank, signed by Grace Daly, and it's titled Notification of Failure to Meet Safety and Soundness Standards and Request for Compliance Plan. Do you recall this document?
Yes.
I sort of thought you would. Did you have input into this?
Oh, absolutely,
document?
Absolutely. The, you know, it was based on the supervisory findings of our exam team and a collection of items that resulted in that.
So what was the driving force? What was your primary concern that led to the creation of this?
Sure. And in fact, I think you have a document that you're going to talk about. Maybe we can bring that forward now. I would also say probably the best starting point would be a letter. I don't know if you pulled it out, which should be 2004-31. Do you have a copy of mine?
Oh, right.
Do you have that one?
Do you have that?
Yes. That was in my other pile, but sure, let's go ahead.
Okay.
So we should mark this one.
28.
You can mark it Waterhouse 28 if you'd like.
No, just 28.
Okay.
Are you just going 1 to infinity with the numbering? Or are you doing 1 to infinity?
We started at 1 and we're going to infinity with the exception of Dugan.
Right.
We're using the Wednesday method as opposed to the Tuesday method.
Okay, so during the course of our work, we had a number of issues that came up that surfaced over time. And as we performed our work, these things would pepper us. And we would have discussions with management. And finally, it got to the point where, as we just said, there's too many of these. We need to formalize it, put it in writing, and we want you, the bank, to figure out what you're going to do about it. So we talk about it, the Japanese private bank issue, which you're probably familiar with by now, where the JFSA, the Japanese Financial Service Agency, did an exam a couple years before, identified issues. The bank supposedly fixed them. Then the JFSA came back and they found some of the same issues. Some of those involved anti-money laundering processes, which was related to anti-social people, which is their code word for people you don't want to deal with. What the bank was frustrated is that there's nothing codified in Japan that talks about antisocial. They're just supposed to know it, and they're supposed to look at newspapers and collect names of people who did bad things. So anyway, that was part of the premise on the JFSA deal. There were instances, as I pulled this out, where we thought that the bank was not being open and honest with the regulators. There was an instance in the JFSA report, the New York Federal Reserve Bank had an issue in City Financial, and there was an instance in Hong Kong which I had forgotten about till I read this, and I don't remember the woman's name, but she was let go after this. She was the head of Hong Kong and was let go. So we had questions about the integrity there. The failure, the third item is related to Pinochet. This was interesting because we went to the bank and said, it was a congressional subpoena, I believe, said, can you produce any items related to Pinochet or people related to Pinochet? And they came back and said, we don't have any. So as we collected documents from the subpoenas from other banks, it became apparent through looking at that information that they actually did. So we went back to them and said, are you sure you don't have any? And are you really, really sure? And finally, they came back and said, oh, yeah, by the way, here's some Pinochet documents. So then there was a breakdown on the commodities trading desk where a trader broke into the system. This is like an internal control issue with the system. This happens periodically with these traders, but this was not in and of itself that big of a deal. The MTS trade, the Dr. Evil trade.
Right.
We all know that one. And then on this one here, because of the proximity of the formal agreement, I referenced the formal agreement. So we had all of these issues. And then later on, I know you also pulled out my letter to Bob Druskin and Ed Green, where we talked about trading of products. So that one came right on the heels of this one, if I remember the dates right.
I believe you're referring to document 26 from Frank.
Correct. Okay. So that this one came right on the heels of this other letter of concern. And what we had done is, as we had done our work, as we work our way through the trading desk, we had found instances where the bank had commenced trading products without getting regulatory approval, like electricity derivatives is referenced here. So in order for them to trade electricity derivatives, they need to get a formal written approval. They have to ask and get a formal written approval from the OCC. That's one of those instances where supervision, policy, and legal all work together to do that. So these two things kind of came together at this at roughly the same time. So what, back to this first document.
Right.
What we asked the bank to do is develop a corrective action plan. And in this instance, Chuck Prince, both of them signed it, but Chuck and Bob Wilmstead, who is the president of Citigroup, president and COO, and Chuck being the chief executive at that time, they put together this document behind it, which is a huge document. I mean, they really, really put a lot of effort into it. They got a big binder of the five-point plan and how they were going to roll this thing out. And, you know, this kind of summarizes what they want to do. They did a lot of town halls.
Just let me interrupt for a second. For the record, we'll mark this as 29. This is a January 18th, 2005 letter with one attachment.
Are you're talking about the attachment to the document 28?
Correct. That is,
yes.
That's the bank's response. It's 29.
Dated January 18, 2005 to Mr. Waterhouse.
Correct.
So, I interrupted. Go ahead. You were describing this.
So, at any rate, this is we had these issues. In fact, we had meetings with Chuck Prince down here, then acting controller Julie Williams and Grace Daly to talk about this stuff. And they knew, these two individuals, the bank knew that we were contemplating some type of action against them. And what at this point I would say Chuck was very much trying to avoid any type of corrective action, so they're trying to get in front of it. And this is actually a pretty good effort on their part, but at the end of the day we decided to proceed with the Part 30. And the Part 30 is really designed to take the issues that were in both of these documents and have the bank develop a more comprehensive plan to address the issues that surrounded that.
And by the two documents, you're talking about the November 15, 2004 letter to the bank, number 28, and the January 6, 2005 letter to the bank, document number 26.
Correct. So what we did is, notwithstanding the bank's response here, we went ahead and issued a notice of deficiency and asked the bank to prepare a plan on how they would fix these types of issues. And the bank responded with a plan that we didn't like. We went back to them, and then they responded with another plan that that we accepted. And it was a 400-plus action item plan that that was global in nature.
Do you remember the approximate date of this 400-plus action item plan? When they submitted it?
Yeah, I don't. I actually have a copy of one of, because they would submit it to us every month. So we constantly were getting this thing updated, and we'd meet with them every month. So we'd see the progress on that. So that many of the items that were in the Part 30 were contemplated in this Chuck Prince response here. And I think they were able to use that response, that document, as the foundation for much of their corrective action. The hard part for them was executing it and getting it embedded throughout the company. So what we had in there, now what was interesting about this, these instances that we talk about in here are really instances of anti-money laundering controls, internal controls with respect to systems and technology, and issues with respect to global name searches on that. So these were internal controls, operations, and compliance, the oversight from them. And so the Part 30 is really tailored to address the issues in those areas.
Okay. So if we look at Frank number 9, it's a letter from you to Mr. Rollauer, if that's how you pronounce it, dated September 19, 2005.
Yeah, this.
So that's where you rejected the.
Good, nice try. Because what they actually, I don't remember the original plan. I don't remember if it's even exists anymore, but they, it was pretty vague. So what we wanted is we wanted specifics. We wanted people, we wanted times, we wanted action items very specifically so that we could track that. And then we wanted Tom to tell us about it so we wouldn't have to do it. So those were those monthly meetings.
And what was Mr. Rollauer's function at Citigroup or Citibank?
He was brought in originally as the global head of compliance. And then during the course of time, and I don't remember exactly when it happened, but he moved into this executive director for corporate policy and regulatory relations position, and they brought in a guy named Martin Wong to be global head of compliance. Martin was more effective in getting things done than Tom was. Tom was an external guy brought in to be global head of compliance, and that's a very difficult thing to do when you're in an institution that big and you don't have the connections, you don't know how the machinery works. So Martin actually came in and did a better job of it. So Tom's job wound up being the Part 30 in large part, and whatever else these executive directors do.
Okay. Fair enough. So, as in your role as EIC, do you sort of set the schedule for, okay, we're going to look at this desk this quarter, we're going to look at that desk that quarter? I mean, how do you pick which of the many myriads of things at
right.
bank as large as Citibank are going to be examined on what sort of right. cycle or period?
Right. We do an annual supervisory strategy. I'm going through that right now at my other place. Had a big long meeting yesterday to talk about just that, but it is a process that is more bottom up than top down.
Okay.
What I will do, and like what I did yesterday, is talk about the major things that are affecting the bank, the group, the major initiatives that are coming out of Washington. We just had a manager's meeting last week. You know, we couldn't meet last week. Talk about the big things there. And then what the team leaders will do, will take that information and, from the bottom up, look at the risks in the various areas that they're responsible for and look for those desks that they're most concerned about in the trading area, because at retail you're doing cards and stuff like that. But in the look at the various desks that they have the most concerns about, or that have we have questions about risk management, or that are growing the most rapid. And it depends on really the amount of information we get on those things as to which ones we'll actually pick. But they will identify the ones that they believe, the team leaders that they believe, require an examination. Now those sometimes will happen quite rapidly upon one another. We have an instance now where we're going right back after 6 months because we thought that it was important to get back in there. Others, like foreign exchange trading, it's a fairly generic business. It's mainly automated. We get a lot of good information and statistics on it. We see the audit reports. So those ones we may not examine as frequently, but we will go in there on a longer horizon. So they'll come up to me, provide a written supervisory strategy. It'll be a multi-page document that says, these are the risks, these are what we're thinking about, and this is what we want to what we think we ought to examine. In between those exams, there's a lot of information that we do just through ongoing, what we call ongoing supervision. We get reports on an ongoing basis. We talk to management on an ongoing basis, collect a lot of information, and that will cause us to, in many times, change that strategy, confirm that we definitely want to go in there, look at something, or decide that it's no longer that much of a concern. So we'll make adjustments along the way. So we'll start out with a plan, and during the course of time, we'll wind up hitting probably 80% of that plan. Some things might be pushed a little bit. Some things will be advanced. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's the form of this, like, a memo from the team leaders. Each team leader sends you sort of my supervisory plan for the upcoming year, or do they all sign one big thing? It's like...
It's discreet. Each individual team leader will present one. Having said that, one of the things that I do, and the John Lyons of the world will try to do, and what I was doing yesterday, is that there are common risks among the different areas. And I locked my guys in a room, and we talked about, I said, what are your big risks? Everyone, what is your big risk? What's your big risk? What are you doing? How are you going to examine that? When are you going to examine it?
Right.
What kind of skills do you need there? And then somebody might say, well, and in particular, this works out like on the retail side, where somebody's going to do some mortgage stuff. So we're going to do a mortgage exam. We're going to look at modifications or something like that.
Right.
And then my compliance team leader says, well, we really need to look at flood. Can we have somebody come along to look at flood insurance reg? So that type of stuff will happen.
Okay.
So it is, what it works even goes down further, because it's on the team. Each team, Ron has 6 or 7 or 8 people reporting into him with the screen. They'll all recommend up to him. He'll compile that, and it'll all come into one document. So there'll be one supervisory strategy for each bank for each year.
Okay. I don't think I've seen anything like that in the productions, and it's probably because I wasn't artful enough in asking for it. But when I get back to our office, make a formal request. We'd like to see those.
You're looking for the discrete individual recommendations of each team?
Yes. For the...
Yeah, I would say there is a consolidated supervisory strategy that's ultimately submitted by me and approved by Grace Daly, my deputy.
That would be fine. For the 2005 to 2008 period? For
consolidated examination strategy documents.
Yes. Okay.
2005 through 2008?
2008, beginning of 2005 to the end of 2008.
Right. That should tell you what we're thinking and what we intend to do.
Right.
So that would cover, that's after Scott left, so that
right.
would cover
right.
John Lyons if he does the same.
Right.
We don't know whether he does or
right.
not.
Right, if there is. Right. So the next documents I'm going to ask you to take a look at are 13A and 13B from the Frank interview. And these are sort of, I believe, what you've generically described as a conclusion memo and a cover memo. Have you seen either of these documents
yeah,
before?
Last night.
Okay.
I do. Again, just on process, I would have seen every letter that went to the bank. I would have opined on every letter that went to the bank. I would have commented on every letter. Now, whether I recall them
right.
5 years later. So I do remember this one because it was a little bit more than the ordinary. So
the paragraph to me that sort of stands out is that second paragraph. The findings of this examination are disappointing in that the business grew far in excess of management's underlying infrastructure and control processes. Furthering our concerns is that underlying management processes in the middle office were not capturing relative metrics to determine whether the pace of growth was sustainable and sufficient. Additionally, control functions raised questions as to the business's capacity to accommodate future growth, but warnings went unheeded. And then you skip down to the bottom. Management oversight is considered less than satisfactory.
Just for the record, you're quoting from document number 13A.
13A.
Which is the December 22nd, 2005 letter to the bank from Mr. Frake.
Right. So that's pretty strong language for an examiner, correct? And that last sentence is sort of a technical sentence. Management oversight is considered less than satisfactory because that feeds into that exam report rating, I believe. Is that correct?
That would feed, we have two different rating systems
right.
to aggregate things.
Yeah, not the CAMELS rating.
It would feed into the risk assessment, price risk.
Yes, that's, I misspoke, the risk assessment.
Price risk, management rating.
Right.
Right. So this would be one component that Ron would consider as he pulls together all the work during the quarter.
So why don't you explain sort of the basis for this document, if you understand what the basis for...
Okay, let save the exam-specific details because I wasn't involved in the exam.
Right.
But I do know that Ron and I had discussions about this, and he had some frustrations with this. This will jump us forward to our report of exam as well.
For which year, do you know?
2005.
Okay.
I believe. Do you have that there?
Yes, I think that's break 17.
Go to the price risk comment in there.
Which is page 12?
Yes. Okay, so Ron did an assessment of three books, if I recall, on this one. Three different books. And, yeah, structured finance, total return swaps, credit trading, and correlation trading.
What
this is on page 4 of 13B.
Okay.
So in that examination, he looked at three different books that I am assuming must have been under a common manager, which is why he would do that. I'm assuming that today. Normally, if it's a book, we would send a letter to that the manager of that book. But these ones, given this, I'm assuming that he did that. So he obviously identified issues in the correlation trading book that he thought needed to be corrected. In the other two books, he thought management was satisfactory. And so as he thought about that, those three would have contributed to his risk assessment rating and his development of this. Now, as he, in his deliberative process, determined that based on the facts and circumstances that rather than management being unsatisfactory, that they were less than satisfactory. Part of what we did after this event was to go to the senior risk officer, Bushnell, and tell him that we had instances where we thought independent risk management was ineffective and not challenging the business. So we went to Dave. Ron and I sat in that meeting, and we thought, and this is one of the, it's a very difficult thing to do, in the sense to say that your independent risk managers didn't do something or didn't effectively challenge, because that's not documented at all times.
Right.
You don't have this situation where you sit across from a trader and say, get rid of that. So it's hard for us, and we thought we had an instance where, here's a great example, we're going to take you down. Now we have a great example where independent risk management tried to do a job and the business blew them off. That's what we thought. So we went to Dave to talk to him about it. And Dave, and this is on page 12 of the report exam, we were sufficiently concerned about this, we wound up putting it in the report, but we went to Dave and he told us that he approved the growth in business. So here's what happened then, is that the independent risk managers in the line expressed concern about this.
Would that be Murray Barnes? Would you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if it would be Murray Barnes. I don't know who it would be.
Okay.
But they expressed concern, thought the business ought to slow down. And apparently the business called Dave apparently. Dave said, go ahead. So Dave told us he approved it. So then the question comes back to, okay, we thought that, the comment being that we thought that independent risk management didn't exercise judgment was then called into question because Bushnell just told us he did it.
Right.
He's independent risk management.
Right.
So what do you do with that? So what Ron and I did, what we did was this. This is in the report of exam to the board of directors. I think we had an instance where we didn't feel comfortable with risk management. We had the senior risk officer telling us that he approved it. Yet, we can't say, you know, Dave, I disagree with you, or Dave, we're not sure. So we kind of couched it. I think we went as far as we could go in a formal document to the letter of the board to say that we were pretty uncomfortable with this situation. And I will tell you, Dave didn't like it when we wrote it. So that's kind of the context between this Jeff Coley memo and how we wound up in the report of exam and some of the dialogue that we had back and forth with Dave Bushnell, the senior risk officer.
So, again, to sort of ask your calendar question, the memo went to out on December 22nd.
Correct.
The exam report was transmitted on March 31st.
Right.
When do you think you might have met?
It would have been between those dates. It would have been after this letter, but before we issued the report of exam.
Between December 2005.
And March. And would you typically calendar something like that on Outlook, a meeting with Bushnell,
mm-hmm.
so that we could probably ascertain the date of it if your computer hasn't crashed?
My computer's crashed. I just, we could try.
Okay.
The question would be, we have a number of meetings with Bushnell. Which meeting would it have been?
Gotcha. So let's go to FRAIC 15, which is dated March 6th, 2006. And it's signed by Mr. Coley, if that's how you pronounce it.
Coley, yeah.
And it appears to be on its face a response to his December 22nd, 2005 letter.
Correct.
Would you recall this document, or
again, I would have received a copy of this document. I would have read it. I saw it again last night, but as to the substance, what this would be again is, as you suggest, Coley saying, you know, we hear you, we got your letter, and we're going to address the issues.
So when I spoke when we interviewed Ron the other day. He said that it was his belief that Citibank management had sort of taken to heart what you and he had said, and that this was the evidence of that. Mm-hmm. And it was his belief that they were going to start implementing appropriate independent risk management procedures. Was that your feeling as well?
Yeah, it was. And in fact, I will say, as a quick aside, notwithstanding all these issues with Citi over time, when we issued an MRA, when we issued a supervisory letter, they responded, and they responded appropriately. They would not blow us off. And I think in this case that Coley was trying to address the issues. And in fact, many times, there would be organization changes. Once in a while, somebody would wind up out on the street. We're being very careful with that. So I think in this case, and as Ron, if he responded that he thought that it was addressing it, I'm sure he and I had those conversations as we rolled up into our report of exam that year, too.
Does anyone need a break? We've been going for about an hour and a half.
Scott?
So let's go on to document that's we've titled FRAIC 18. It's a what appears on its face to be a review by OCC examiner. Is it Ms.?
Yeah, Jahan Lipinski.
Lipinski. It appears the review date is June 2006 and that the deal date was January 11th, 2006. I assume this is far enough down the totem pole that this did not come to your attention. Do you recognize?
I can speak to this. I don't recognize it.
Okay.
I can,
okay.
If you want some background on what's going
on
here.
Sure.
Jahan, as I mentioned before, Bruce Johnson had two reports. Jahan was one of them.
Right.
And what this this work paper is, and I did not review it. I looked at what Jahan wrote. Is part of our assessment of the bank's compliance with the formal agreement. Every quarter, we would get a list of all CMAQ deals every quarter, and we'd sample them every quarter to see what was happening, to see if they were indeed complying with the formal agreement. So you would have, if as you dug through the work papers, you would have seen any number of these similar documents. We're looking to see, are you complying with the document? And as far as the formal agreement, in addition to just the CMAQ things, we would sample elsewhere to see if there were deals that didn't go to CMAQ that should have gone to CMAQ and try to see those. Plus, we do our shared national credit. So we looked at the formal agreement in a lot of ways. So Jahan went through this thing. Her job in this was to determine whether it complied with the formal agreement. And so this worksheet that she's going through is really a worksheet that maps to the formal agreement. I believe it maps it pretty closely. So she is not evaluating the risk of the business or the management of the business. What she's doing is seeing if this really is substantively part of the formal agreement. And in fact, what struck me is on page 3 of this document.
Yes.
In that box under credit analysis, she makes the comment that that is there an appropriately thorough and documented analysis? She says yes for the customer, for the customer's intended purpose. She said yes, and she says appropriate analysis is intended for the product, intended for the product rather than the customer. So what is what she's saying here is that we should talk about the formal agreement and what it meant. What she's saying is that this is a product. It's not a complex structured transaction for a customer. So in other words, this is not relevant to the formal agreement. That's what that means.
Okay.
Why don't you take a moment and describe the purpose of the formal agreement, which was entered into in July 2003.
Do you want to spend time on that?
Sure.
Okay, so welcome to the city. This was going on when I joined. It's important to go back and think about what was going on with Enron and WorldCom and those entities.
Right.
And what Citi and JP and the others were doing with them. I don't know if you had involvement in that back then or not, but the deal that was going on with that is that the banks were using structured products to create financing for Enron in such a way that it wouldn't show up on Enron's balance sheet. So they were doing these deals with prepaid oil things. They were doing deals with barges. They were structuring things to get money into Enron but not have it show up on the financial statements. So the formal agreement is designed to deal with the issue of how the bank deals with its customers, how the bank structures products for its customers. And in fact, here, you know, as you go through like Jahan's deals and the formal agreement, much is talked about: does the customer understand what it's doing? Does the customer disclose this in his financial statements? So, we're trying to make sure that these transactions are known to the customer's board and that they're disclosed properly on their financial statements and that there's no accounting gimmick smoke and mirrors.
Right.
So that's kind of the intent of that. So as we went through it, we tested that. We had, you would have seen, I'm sure, huge boxes. We over and over we tested this, And the bank, in its initial work on this, basically got out of that business. They didn't structure deals like that. There may be miscellaneous things that would have happened, but for the most part, we felt really good that they had put the policies and procedures and controls in place to be able to keep that. And I would say, too, that when you fast forward to the current day and all the losses that that company, the city took, none of them relate to the issues that were behind the formal agreement. So it's completely different.
Right.
The formal agreement was designed for individual customers as opposed to products or broader risk issues.
To put it in sort of layman's terms, Freight 2, which is the July 2003 formal agreement, was designed to sort of prevent the bank from being involved with customers who were up to perhaps nefarious stuff with their balance sheet or with their tax policy.
Correct.
It wasn't designed to protect the bank, the bank's balance sheet or credit risk. It was designed to protect the bank's reputation, because if you're involved with
Correct.
People doing nefarious things, that doesn't look so good.
Plus you have big losses.
Right.
So that was this document, number 18, and that's what Jahan's doing. So she's not evaluating the business or the risk management of the business. She's just seeing if does this thing, how does it comply with the formal agreement? Is there an issue with that? And she did this over and over again, and Bruce did this over and over again.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, we saw many of these in the binder.
And so that was the point. We, like I say, the OCC did a lot of we. Huge amount of time testing this thing.
Right.
So
it looks like it. So if we can, sticking with document 18, if we can go into the document. It's the seventh physical page. It says product/control summary-CDS on MBS ABS. So on its face, this appears to be an internal Citigroup document that mm-hmm. may have been submitted as part of this process. In looking at the document, it says business sponsors, and then lists 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 names, including Jeffrey Perlowitz. Preliminary approval by business manager. It has three names, including Randall Costa. Do you know who Mr. Perlowitz and Mr. Costa are?
No. Actually, I don't recognize any of those names.
So you wouldn't know if they were Citibank or Citigroup employees.
Or dual employees.
Or dual employees, which I suspect may be the case. If you look under the chart, it says legal booking entity, Citibank N.A.
Correct.
Does that mean that when this product is eventually created, that it will actually be on Citibank's books as opposed to one of the non-bank entities?
My expectation, based on that, would be yes, that it would
be Citibank. But this more or less, the document speaks for itself.
How familiar were you with the limits that the Treasury Department put on the liquidity puts at Citibank once the liquidity put issue bubbled up?
Yeah, I didn't know through the course of the liquidity puts of their existence,
right?
Let alone their limits,
right?
Through the course of this, there was a $25 billion limit that was imposed, I believe, by the Treasury downtown, the CIB Treasury, Corporate Investment Bank Treasury, that was put on that. And that was reconfirmed through all my rereading in the last couple of days, that it was in there. I believe that, I was told that at some point in late 2005, I'm in 2007.
So you learned of it in 2007 when all these issues came?
Yeah. As I said before, I didn't even know the liquidity puts existed.
Right. So how could you know about the limits if you didn't know they existed, right?
So just so it's clear, you learned about it in late 2007?
Yeah, it would have been sometime after in after that Bushnell call that all this stuff started coming together for me.
The Bushnell call about the anticipated losses.
Correct.
Tell me what you know about the differences and the similarities and the operations of the New York desk that was involved in CDOs and the London desk that was involved in CDOs at Citigroup and Citibank.
That started out like a really tough question, but it's actually, I can't really speak to it, so it turns out to be easy for me. I do. My main sense is that the London stuff was on the bank's books. The New York stuff was not completely on the bank's books, but I don't know. And that's a question for Ron. That's one that I would have to go to Ron and say, tell me about that. So I don't know.
So here's an easy question. Okay, let's go to Frank 19. It's a document dated November 21st, 2006. Mm-hmm. To you from Bruce Johnson, recommendation for removal of formal agreement.
Right.
Do you recall this document?
I recall all the discussions. This specific document, yeah, I would have seen, and I would have read, and I would have talked to Bruce about it. And I reread it, so.
So what was your state of mind at the time, if you recall, when you received this document about Citibank's compliance with the formal agreement and overall their risk management procedures with respect to complex structured financial transactions?
Right. And again, given the scope of what the formal agreement was intended to do, we had, and Bruce and I had talked about this, we had, you know, did the supervisor strategy. They had done quarterly CMAC testing. We had done shared national credits every year, shared national credits annually, where we had elements. We had procedures in there to check for structured financing. So we sampled the loan portfolio. We did a huge amount of work. And the bank was, we felt, in compliance with the agreement. What happened earlier in this year, and at this point in time, was that we had satisfied ourselves that the bank was doing what it said. It had exited the business. It had policies and procedures that dealt with the tax, legal, accounting. And it had the CMAC process enhanced and all that. So we felt pretty comfortable with that. But what we didn't, when we did a final check on that, is we went back into audit, found that audit had not actually done what it had been required to do. So we held up.
Can you, at what point did you determine that audit had not?
That would have been, thanks, Linda.
But it was part of the November 2006 recommendation.
It's in our report of exam, and it would have been our 2005 report of exam. Do you have that?
The 2005?
Yeah. 2005 report of exam.
That's 17, isn't it?
Let's see here.
So what, the risk management?
Or? No. Right up. Yeah. Okay, so in the report of exam, right here, says, well, let me read it to you. I'm the witness, right? So, it says, the board is directed to three matters requiring attention. Citi continues to be subject to the formal agreement with the OCC regarding flex charge financing. While we found that each business is in substantial compliance with the agreement, audit needs to broaden its testing to ensure that business conduct remains consistent with the intent of the agreement. So we specifically held up releasing the agreement that's yours. That's ours. Okay. Because audit wasn't doing its job, and the whole point of that is that, you know, we are the regulators. We are the last line of defense in this. You got managing, the risk management, compliance. You got audit. You've got external audit.
Right.
In us.
Right.
So I'm thinking audit has to be able to go through there and have a program where it's going to test all this stuff and validate that they're still in compliance with this after we lift the agreement. So we did not lift the agreement, much to the dismay of the bank. When Sandy Weill retired, they wanted to hand him with a document that said the formal agreement's gone, and we didn't do it. So that was the point at that. So it'd be, to your point, it would have been in late
Mark.
2005 that we would have done that. So we held up issuing, releasing the document until we were comfortable that audit developed procedures that addressed everything in the agreement. And then we spent, if I remember the time frame, those procedures were developed and formalized in about May time frame of 2006. They used them right away, and then we went in right after they were done and looked at it, and then we felt comfortable at that point in time that they had the processes in place. And so that was at the point in time when Bruce came and said, done. And my frame of mind to your original question is that I think the formal agreement served its purpose. There was, it's like old cheese in the refrigerator. There's no reason to keep it around. The bank was out of the business. The bank had the processes. Audit was working. There was no reason to keep it around anymore.
And what was your frame of mind regard at this time, November 2006, regarding the overall risk management procedures or scope for complex structured financial transactions?
For complex, for the elements that relate to formal agreement,
no.
It was fine. Beyond that, we still had issues. But that wasn't in the scope of the formal agreement.
Right. Right. No, I understand that.
And so what we have is, in the other documents we're talking through, we still had MRAs outstanding. We still had, like, this Coley stuff. We still had MRAs where we're expecting the bank to make corrective actions. And so just because we took the agreement off doesn't mean that we still don't have the maneuver or the levers to get the bank to do things. So we will continue, and you would see those in all the documents that we're working on. That's how we were working with, that's how we were dealing with independent risk management, was through the exam process, the formal report of exam, and supervisory letters.
But with respect to Mr. Coley, you'd received a letter in March that we've already referred to.
Right.
In which he basically, I thought, had alleviated your concerns about the issues that had been raised in the Frank 2005 review. Is that, am I not understanding?
Does kind of.
No, that counts. So you thought they had, it kind of.
Yeah, and had Coley, and again,
I don't want to go back to that letter.
The Coley issues, the issues raised in the Coley letter were big issues. And in a company like Citi, it's never a quick fix. So, and I say kind of because while Coley had provided a plan of action where they were going to address these issues, we still felt it was significant enough that we referenced it in that 2005 report of exam. 2005 report of exam is actually written in the first quarter of 2006.
Right.
So that was contemporary to that. So that was part of our thinking. While they have a plan to do it, we've been promised a lot of things by that bank over the years. A plan is one thing, but corrective action being completed is often a different thing. So that's why, kind of, we still felt compelled to put that type of issue in the report of exam to the board of directors.
Okay, well, let's look at the Ron Frank letter that we
to
Coley, 15.
Okay.
Let's go to page 5.
Okay.
Top of page 5, although 20 individual synthetic CDO transactions were brought for CMAQ approval between 2003 and 2005, correlation trading was never referred to CMAQ for review and approval as an ongoing business in its evolution from a series of isolated transactions to a replicable business. Management believes that the processes are now in place to ensure that growing and evolving businesses receive requisite scrutiny. Implementation of the IRC increased attentiveness to infrastructure issues in the CMAQ approval process and formalized monitoring of CMAQ approval conditions as described in detail below are key. So, when you say kind of, does that mean that you were comfortable with their stated intent about their policies and procedures, but until you saw where the rubber met the road and saw their actual practices, that you still had concerns about their ability to implement what they said they were going to implement?
We would frequently receive comments from the bank that says management believes that the processes are now in place, but we would not remove MRAs until we were comfortable that that indeed was the case. So, yes, where the rubber meets the road, we would always go and test it.
So that brings us to FRAC 20, which is the 2006 report of examination. I assume you're familiar with this document.
Can I? No, I read this. I think this is a good report. I think both 2005 and 2006, these are good reports.
Okay.
But
well, tell me why you think that.
There's. As we assess Citibank and the national banks under Citigroup, we do a lot of work, and there's extensive amount of effort that goes into this to try to determine the risk characteristics of the bank and the management controls. We had done we had seen over the course of several years here a lot of work on the formal agreement, a lot of work on the Part 30, and a lot of individual exams. You're pulling out exams kind of related to the areas that lost money, right?
Right.
But we can't forget that Citibank is a huge company that has a lot of other businesses, that has a lot of other activities. We spent a lot of time over there, and those were all like, they're okay. So we pull all this together, and we make an assessment at the end of the year based on our best judgment. And I think as I read this, There are big issues here still facing the bank. Loan loss reserves are a big issue. And we had a number of knockdown dragouts with respect to loan loss reserves. We had some, let me see if this is when we downgraded capital. Because at this point.
Yes.
Yeah, we did. We downgraded capital in this report. And the reason why we took capital from a 1 to a 2, and the reason why is that the bank had lost sight, to a limited degree, I would say, was not paying attention to its leverage ratio, and so it was gearing up more. So as it was gearing up more, we had concerns about that. And when we put it in here, that kind of put the pressure on it. It was interesting, and in fact, the meeting that we had with the audit committee was interesting because while we were downgrading it, at the same time, the Fed gave them kind of a mulligan with respect to leverage ratio. They allowed them to go from 5% down to 4% on their leverage ratio. So it was
that was contemporaneous.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was an interesting discussion because I had to explain where we were concerned about leverage in the bank, and then Diane Dobeck was explaining her position, and so that was a delicate dance we had to do to say, why is that? But we were concerned that they were increasing assets too rapidly as such. That's why we downgraded this. So I think the loan loss reserves, we can talk about that at some point if you're interested, because I think there's a big story behind that as well.
Well, but tell me.
We've got a team of 40 to 50 examiners there,
right,
interfacing with the bank, working hard. These guys are working hard. And these guys did a good job. And as we pulled this up, I think this is a good report, and I think it's accurate. Now, you can challenge me on that But I feel at this point in time, when we wrote this, this is what the company was. Loan loss reserves, because there was an earlier question that I had seen coming from Linda on loan loss reserves. But let me give you a little chronology here.
Okay.
Back in 2002, I believe, Citigroup bought California Federal Savings. Right?
Yep.
At that point in time, Citigroup determined that CalFed would be its primary retail outlet. So mortgages, autos, consumer lending, student lending was all in CalFed. You have a subsequent request for information on UDAP, unfair, deceptive. That's important to remember because beginning in about 2002, the retail activities for most of Citigroup were outside the bank, except credit cards and New York State stuff, because at that point in time, Citibank was chartered in New York.
Right.
So its retail stuff there was in the bank.
Right.
Okay, so from 2002 until October of 2006, that was outside the bank. Part of the problem that we always had, and you'll see it going through all these documents, is that Citibank was unwieldy. Citigroup was unwieldy. Lots of legal entities. It never had a passion to integrate systems, to get onto common platforms. It would want to service its customers as best it could and then kind of leave the back office to be done, in often cases by brute force. You just get it done. So at any rate, we all had discussions with the bank on trying to simplify its legal vehicle structure to try to eliminate this, get rid of regulators, get rid of this cross legal entity issues. And they embarked on a program to simplify legal vehicles through the course of, say, 2005 and into 2006. Their objective, speaking for the bank, was they wanted one big broker-dealer, one big bank, and one big credit card bank. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in October of 2006, this all came to fruition. And what happened at that point in time is that CalFed was converted into the National Bank. It became part of Citibank. Citibank South Dakota, the credit card bank, was moved out of the bank and merged with Citibank Nevada. We may talk about that later too. But Citibank Nevada, the small credit card bank, they got the one credit card bank, they got the bank. And then there's a bunch of other stuff out in the broker-dealer, too.
Right.
Okay, so at that point in time, we had the mortgage company come in. And throughout the course, you know, I talked to Michael Helfer and Company about subprime lending in the consumer side, and they'd always assured me they don't have any. But anyway, the mortgage company came in, and we did a small pre-conversion exam, and then we got the OTS report of exam that it had issued. And OTS had rated asset quality 1, pristine. So this came into the bank, and I felt pretty good about it because now Citi, which had up to then been primarily a commercial bank,
right,
now had a much broader, much more diversified franchise. Good risk management, diversity, a lot of good mortgages. So I felt, okay, the company is in a better position now than it was a year ago because, you know, it's now a full service bank in essence. That's part of the thing. So anyway, what happened after that is that we started, as we do every year, doing our loan loss reserve work.
Right.
So there was a point to this whole story. So we started doing our allowance for loan and lease loss work. And as we went into the work that they did on the newly converted OTS work, We thought that they were deficient on that. Okay. We actually, I want to say deficient. We couldn't understand why they were at the level they were at. That's a better way to phrase it.
Okay.
Now, having said that, over the course of time, and you would have seen it, that on the commercial side, we had had MRAs in 2004 and 2005, maybe 2003, during earlier in my time, about the quality of its analysis, the bank's analysis with respect to loan loss reserve. In about 2005, we declared victory. We felt good about the commercial loan loss reserve that the bank had. And in fact, it had a nice little cushion on it that we felt good about it, and the bank could support it. So at year-end 2006, we had this OTS asset come in and a bunch of other stuff that we weren't sure about.
Right.
We had on the other side the commercial loan loss reserve that we felt really comfortable with. We thought it was, you know, well-reserved. So on balance, we thought, okay. So there starts a series of discussions with bank management where we raised the issue. They said, we think there's an issue with the loan loss reserves on the consumer side, to which their response is, how can that be? The OTS examined it. They didn't have a problem. And to our response is that it's an interagency policy, FFIC policy on loan loss reserves. It's one policy. I don't know what the OTS did. All I know is that we're looking at it, and you guys need to better support it. So we went through this whole dialogue. Chuck Prince is jumping up and down. How could this happen? Michael Helfer says, if we had known that you were going to increase our loan loss reserves, we would never have consolidated indication on management. Because they like that regulatory bit. But so we started working on it. We got management to start going on it. Then we had some discussions with the Fed, and I think the Fed was not entirely comfortable with where we were going with the loan loss reserves. And I think the language in our report of exam is delicately written to recognize that the Fed was not going to partner with us as far as telling the bank that they really need to pick it up.
And who at the Fed would have you had?
Well, that would have been Diane Dobeck at the time.
Right.
We had a lot of discussions with her. That was a struggle. That was frustration. You know, we got over it. I'm dealing with the bank. I'm writing to the bank, and so it was fine. The other part of that they had the City Financial subsidiary. That was where all the subprime stuff would have been done, completely outside the bank.
Right.
And the bit that was a little bit frustrating is that the Fed didn't apply this loan loss reserve policy to the City Financial. So there were kind of gaps in loan loss reserve adequacy. So that was kind of the struggle. And when you read the 2006 report of exam, that's why I say the language in there on loan loss reserve is fairly delicately framed, just so that we are speaking with we're common with the Fed, because they're issuing the same report. But it was a bit of a struggle. There are some late emails and stuff that you may be able to see that, you know, express my frustration as I email back and forth with the Fed. You haven't seen them yet, but my candor gets a little.
So this would have been in the 2006.
This would have been 2000, early
07 when the report was being written.
Early 07, yes, yes, indeed. We had any number of conversations with the Board of Governors, our accountants, KPMG, us, trying to get on the same page, and it was just a real struggle. So anyway, the whole point is that's where that loan loss reserve comment comes in. I did feel comfortable calling it adequate based on what our understanding of the risk in the mortgage portfolio, plus what they had on the corporate side. In aggregate, in the legal entity, they were fine. So the other thing, just to round out a thought since I'm on a roll, is on the mortgage stuff, as we think about the risks in there, as that entity, as we will fast forward to 2007 and 8 and losses that ultimately occurred, as we integrated that, as the bank integrated the mortgage company into Citibank in late 2006, if you think about the time of that, the 2005, second half 2005 and 2006 vintages for mortgages were already out there, done under the thrift, right? And those are bad vintages. The 2007 vintage was already geared up and ready to go. So we actually got this stuff. So a lot of the losses we're now seeing in 2008 and 9 map back to that period of time when we got a one-rated asset.
Right. So I think I've gone through all the emails that have been produced by the OCC.
Right. We're preparing our rolling production with Citibank material, which we're trying, is like over 100,000 pages, and his emails that he's referring to will be in that production.
Okay, great. So let's go back to the exam report.
Whatever your question was, right?
Well, no, that's what I said at the very beginning. When there's something important, I want you to tell me what you think's important, right? Because obviously, you know this 100 times better than I ever will.
I raise that because I do think, for 2 points, some of the later losses emanated from that.
Right.
Second point is that I think we might have had the opportunity to get the bank to have higher reserves in 2006, so they might have over-earned then, under-earned in 2007. We might have been able to affect, I don't know if the timing would have worked, but we were certainly, we certainly got the hair on the back of their necks up. So.
Right. We need to
take a break?
Sorry, I'm okay.
Let me suggest a short break, essentially. Because we've been gone for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shall we turn off the...
Yes.
I'm sorry. No, that's okay.
It's now 11 a.m.
The recording is back on at 11:04.
Okay, let's go back to the examination report. Is 20. And
this is the 2006 ROE?
Yes. So let's go to page 8. And I'd like to have you take a minute to read the two paragraphs under price risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the language I'm interested in is the beginning of the second paragraph. Price risk management remains satisfactory. Management is capable and experienced and has implemented the appropriate levels of control and oversight. All businesses are subject to multiple levels of limits set by market risk management. Model validation remains an issue of regulatory concern. Close quote. So, reading this on its face, I get the impression that there are some issues with the models that you're concerned about, but that on whole, as it says, that you're satisfied with the risk management of this business. Is that a fair reading of what this says?
By what business?
The price risk business, I guess, would be the capital markets businesses, the things subject to the trading marks. In particular, of course, we're thinking about the CDOs, both in London and New York.
Right. So the overall assessment is we looked at the various trading desks and the various business so our assessment at this point in time would be, yeah, it is satisfactory and that the appropriate controls are in place. The CDO's warehousing is not in the bank. Not that I don't know anything about the risk controls over that. But there are the bank does have overlapping limits for, as far as we knew at the time, all the desks that were appropriate.
And as we've looked at the prior document on the CMAQ approval document, and from my discussions with Mr. Frake, it's my understanding that generally synthetic CDOs were on the bank's balance sheet.
Correct. As far as I knew, yes. Or as far as I know.
Right. So, reading that third sentence, all businesses are subject to multiple levels of limits set by market risk management, one would think that that covered the synthetic CDOs on the bank's balance sheet.
Yeah, one would think that. And that probably a miss.
And by probably a miss, what do you mean?
I don't know. If indeed that the I don't know the circumstances behind it. And in fact, I only in reading stuff last night saw that the synthetic business may not have had a limit. My expectation is that if it should have had a limit, if it didn't, should have had a series of limits, if it didn't. So I was not aware of that. And I'm sure Ron was not aware of that, but I can't speak for him.
Right. So sort of one of the inherent limits of an examination report like this is it only covers what you actually saw. I mean, you don't know what you don't know, to quote other folks. So given the resources that you have to bear, when you've gone in and tested things, you know what you've tested, but if you haven't looked at a desk, if you haven't tested an operation, obviously you're not able to render a conclusion about that operation.
Right.
Okay.
There are we don't know everything.
I mean, it's a resource issue.
Okay. Well, it could be a resource issue, but if I had thousands and thousands of people in a company as big as Citi, there's always going to be things that you don't know about.
Right.
Things that you have rogue traders. There's in every bank around the country right now, something wrong is going on. You know?
Right.
So it's not necessarily a resource issue. The way we would approach this is through our discussions and understanding with independent risk management. We are of the mind that what they say is that they have risks and limits for all their businesses. That's the framework. They would not operate. They should not be operating without that. If they didn't, if we knew about it, we would probably have a comment on that. Probably. We would have a comment on that. So that's kind of gets back to the emphasis that we had in the formal agreement on audit. That, you know, we're the last level of defense, and all those of management, risk management, compliance, internal audit, external, all those guys need to be there, and somehow or another, if there were no limits there, it got through all of that. So we're told, we have an understanding that the bank runs every business through the CMAQ process and through limit setting process as a set of business limits.
So this sort of goes back to that one issue we talked about where I don't want to call a city banker a citivist, but it seems to be sort of a pattern with them that you spot a problem in one area, you say they're going to address it, and then you have to go back and check because sometimes they don't actually fully comply with what they said they're going to do. Is that, as a generalization, is that sort of accurate?
What we do on those MRAs is we go into tests to make sure that it satisfied what we intended it to be, because there can be interpretation issues as well. Related to that, we've also had discussions with the bank that say that, you know, if we find it here, are you audit and compliance and risk looking for it over here? So,
compared to the other financial institutions you've looked at, your current case or ones prior to Citi, would you say Citi presented any unique challenges because of their structure or their culture, any issues that Citi raises that other institutions don't?
That's a very broad question. You're asking just to make a comment on challenges,
right,
throughout the entire time period that he's,
yeah, just sort of the general
large, right, banks.
Right.
I think the one thing that leaps to mind is the comment that I made earlier about the way in which it acquired companies and didn't integrate everything into common systems. I think that is the biggest thing that affected that company. It affected its ability to pull and aggregate information across the system, and it created inefficiencies through the need to have manual intervention and workarounds and this and that. So I think that was probably one of the biggest things, and something that the bank still struggles with is the IT infrastructure.
Now, my understanding is for a time being, the Fed had a moratorium imposed on Citigroup acquiring additional entities. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah.
And then they subsequently lifted that moratorium.
Correct.
Did they have any discussions with you personally or with anyone at the OCC that you're aware of in making that decision?
You mean the decision to lift
yes.
the moratorium?
Yes.
Not that I recall. Had many conversations about our thinking on the company, but I never, that I can recall, had a conversation, you should lift that, or are you going?
Or they never came over and said, we're thinking about lifting the moratorium on...
Yeah, I don't remember.
They didn't ask. You don't recall being asked for input on that?
I do not recall being asked for input.
Do you find that... Is that unusual or usual in your relationship with the Fed, would you say?
As an EIC of Citibank?
Yeah.
It's, in that case, I wouldn't think it would be unusual for them in that, because the CPC and I would have ongoing dialogue. I think we have biweekly meetings formally, and then we had ongoing discussions. So he or she or he, three of them at the time, would have seen our reports and had an understanding of that. But in that instance, I believe it was the Federal Reserve Board that injected that moratorium on, and I think it was the first Texas acquisition when they approved that. And I can't speak for the Fed, so I'll cut myself off there. So I don't know what the deliberative process was behind that at the time, but I think the examiners on the ground knew what we were thinking, and whoever made the decision, I don't know what they were thinking.
So I just want to make sure I understand your response. Is it your response that it's not unusual for the Fed to do what they did, which is nobody that you recall talked to you? Is that your response?
Well, your question was, did he find it unusual that they did what they did? I thought your question to him was, did he find it unusual that they did what they did without having a personal discussion with him in advance?
Right. So, and I wasn't sure from the answer if I understood whether...
Scott, the question is, unusual personal conversation with you as opposed to conversation with anybody else in the OCC.
Yeah, at that level, because I think documents and decisions like that aren't made at the CPC level, it's probably not all that unusual.
Okay. Do you think it would have been helpful for someone at the Fed to speak to you, the EIC, who's...
You know, on the narrow question of whether they should have lifted that agreement, I don't know, because I wasn't in favor of putting it on in the first place.
Okay.
So, you know, they did it, they had their reasons, and they took care of it. I didn't think it was necessary.
Why didn't you think it was necessary?
Okay, again, back to our assessment of the bank, we had, can I ask when that agreement was put in?
You can, but I don't know.
I don't know the time frame on that. I think of First American Bank, whenever that acquisition was, that's when that happened. And I believe we still had, at that time, we still had a formal agreement and a Part 30 in place. I need help
right.
on that. I need help as far as the time frame. But I thought that the bank's controls were sufficient at that point in time. That it wasn't something that I felt was needed. Now, having said that, if we felt like it was needed, we could have done something. You know, we certainly have it within our authority to make the same pronouncement.
So I'd like to go to document 22 in the break. You had mentioned earlier the senior supervisors group. In this document, which we found in the OCC's New York offices, appears to be some sort of minutes or notes from that meeting, although I don't think we've ascertained who took the minutes or notes. Have you seen this document before?
Yes, I have. I was at the meeting, too.
Yes, it says you were. So, do you know who wrote this document?
I believe it would be Chris Calabia at the New York Fed. So, Chris is the current CPC at Citigroup. Calabia, is he in there?
I don't see his name under the Fed.
I believe Chris was the main scribe for these meetings. So I believe it was him. But whether it was Chris or not, when we held these meetings, the Fed was the one to put down the initial thoughts in each of these documents. So they had the first pen.
Okay.
Then they gave it to us, and then we gave it back, and so we had a chance to comment on it. But they maintained control, so whether they accepted our comments or not was up to them.
Okay. Do you know whether this meeting that apparently took place on November 19, 2007, did it include bank?
Yes, this was a bank meeting. And that November 19th... Yeah, I was actively involved in the SSG at that time. So when we talked about my transition, and I was a little hesitant, that helps with that because I was clearly focused on this stuff at this time.
By this stuff, what do you mean?
SSG stuff.
And that stands for Senior Supervisor Group?
Yeah. Senior supervisors group.
So let's turn to page 2.
Right.
Supervisors' key observations. Then it says, in a few sentences per question, please provide your most significant observations on the following overarching questions. One, in senior management's opinion, what worked well, what did not work well in risk management during the recent period? So, in this document, there's a lot more that didn't work well than did work well. So let's skip down to paragraph number 4 under what did not work well. Senior management, business line, and risk management did not fully appreciate the market risk of the leveraged loan pipeline or of the retained super senior CDO positions. So it's your understanding that the Fed takes the first pen on this, that someone at the Fed would write something like that fourth paragraph and then send it up to the other supervisors, and you would get a chance to comment on it and say
right.
yay or nay.
Right.
Do you specifically recall reviewing this document? Or
yeah, I would have reviewed this.
Okay. Do you recall whether you agreed with that sentiment expressed in the fourth paragraph, that senior management, business line, and risk management did not fully appreciate the market risk?
I think... Go ahead.
I think the discussions about this previously was this the regulator's sentiments or the bank's sentiments? That may be the better question to start with.
Okay. So, as I understand it, this is the supervisor's observation of senior management's opinions. Isn't that what 1-1 is?
Right.
So it's your observation of their opinion. So
this actually more this would be more of a, I don't want to say a transcript, but these are note takings on what management said.
Okay.
Okay. And in this case, I believe this is Dave Bushnell talking.
Okay.
So Dave Bushnell was the main person doing the talking.
Okay.
If you want, I can tell you who I think was also there from the bank.
Sure, that'd be great.
It started out with Bob Rubin presenting his comments, which I think they summarized on the last page. Dave Bushnell, the senior risk officer, Michael Helfer, the general counsel, Jorge Bermudez, this is Jorge, J-O-R-G-E, Bermudez, who was on the phone. He was the designated, he was going to be the new senior risk officer, a position that lasted for him about a month until Chuck Prince left and the commander came in. And others. Gary Crittenden, I believe the CFO, was there as well. Okay, so I believe these comments were those of Dave Bushnell.
Okay.
Sorry, just to identify on page 2 of the document.
Right. So paragraph 4.
Right.
Yes. Wait.
So that's
please ask your question.
Sure.
Again.
So if I understand your statement, it's your recollection that it was Mr. Bushnell who said senior management, business line, and risk management did not fully appreciate the market risk of the leveraged loan pipeline or the retained super senior position.
Yes.
And this accurately reflects what you remember.
Yes.
Two paragraphs below that, the second sentence. The firm did not have a comprehensive view across credit market liquidity and financial accounting risks of its various businesses. That was Mr. Bushnell as well, as you recall.
Correct, yeah.
So if I'm reading that correctly, basically he is saying that risk management failed in its primary job, right? I mean, they didn't have a comprehensive view across credit market liquidity and of the risks of its various businesses. I mean, isn't that what risk management is supposed to do?
It is part of what they're supposed to do. So what I think what Dave is speaking to here is that there were risks in different lines of business across the bank that they were not able to aggregate and get the appreciation of where these risks would have lied. Mortgage risk is a good example of where they struggled to get firm-wide view on the risks. So I think, and then when you in pulling all that together, you would have deficiencies in these elements. So I think from that level, on the leveraged loans and the super senior CDOs, they thought they understood those points. But then, as he said, the market risk was something they didn't appreciate. On the other desk, when you start looking at foreign exchange trading, interest rate derivative trading, of any of these other desks, they have risk, they have controls, and those, they're fine. They have independent oversight. It's just in these concentrated areas where they built up big exposures, they didn't have it right.
And unlike the FX business, the CDO stuff was pretty new, right? I mean, CDOs, as part of Citi's major business lines, 10 years ago, there really wasn't a CDO entity within Citigroup, Citibank, was there?
I don't know, because again, that's outside the bank. That CDO manufacturing and warehousing stuff was outside the bank. I don't know the whole history of that.
Fair enough. So tell me about the meeting. I guess it took place at Citigroup Global headquarters.
Right.
How long did it last, and what was sort of the general tone, and was it the bank officers who were doing most of the speaking at that meeting?
My recollection is probably a four-hour meeting. We had provided questions in advance to the bank, and the bank was responding to the questions. I believe Dave did most of the talking, and we would interject questions, clarifying questions along the way. The tone, Dave is a very personable man, and in settings like that, he's very forthcoming, apparently. So the tone was fine, and they just kind of systematically walked through the questionnaires.
Turn to page 5. Second paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Citigroup's board of directors approved the management plan, accepting Citigroup, quote, needed to take on more risk, close quote. Management and board believed that the issues that faced the firm in 2004-05 were adequately addressed and stronger controls were now in place. Management sought to increase risk-taking in a measured way to improve earnings performance. However, management acknowledged that internal incentives focused too much on earnings growth and not enough on balance sheet usage. Close quote. And this is under the heading Senior Management Oversight Risk Appetite. Is this again Mr. Bushnell, as you recall, or is this?
It would have been. My recollection is that Dave did most of the talking.
Okay. Turning to page 6. Super senior AAA CDO tranches is the first heading on that page. And the first sentence says, an acknowledgement of the risk in its super senior AAA CDO exposure was perhaps Citigroup's, quote, biggest miss, close quote. Again, you think this was probably Mr. Bushnell speaking.
Right.
What's your view of that sentence? Do you agree with that conclusion?
Let me tell you how I think Dave was thinking about that.
Okay.
And because Dave and his team, you know, these are very smart people. These are people that really believe they understood the risks. And on that prior comment you just made, or the prior page, the bank had a lot of pressure from shareholders for its earnings performance, and they were trying to figure out how to improve earnings. The bank, the group, thought that it was, or made the decision to go more heavily into leverage lending and CDO structures. And my sense is that in Dave's mind, he knew that business. He knew those businesses. He knew what they were doing. He knew how to structure it. He knew what they're doing. They knew how to distribute. Dave believed in this originate to distribute model entirely. They'll manufacture it, they'll sell it off, it'll be gone. So he analyzed those two businesses and he felt very comfortable with them. Notwithstanding the market listing, he said he probably needed more. So they made a decision to expand that based on what Dave's concurrence. What I think Dave is saying here is that on the super senior side and the AAA, that he wasn't concerned about that. These were risks that were building, but because they were above AAA and AAA, it didn't get enough attention from him. They should, you know. So my sense is that he's thinking like he focused all his attention on the really complex stuff, and the stuff that's supposed to be no-brainers, AAA risk, he let get out of control. So that's what I think he's referring to as the biggest miss.
Turning to page 7. We're now in the box, communication with board senior executives, that started at the bottom of page 6. The third paragraph there, Citigroup, however, missed the, quote, mortgage correlation, close quote. It historically ran its business on a decentralized basis. In retrospect, Citigroup realized other parts of the firm were seeing early signs of deterioration in the mortgage sector early on during the market dislocation, such as the consumer bank and the mortgage trading desk. This information was not effectively communicated to the CDO structuring business to take action. Close quote. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think Citi ran its businesses separately. It did not have systems to integrate this. I don't know if I'm struggling whether we formally communicated that, but we had similar concerns that it needed to look across the firm to be able to identify common risks. And it comes a little bit back to my earlier comment about where you see it, something popping up on one business, they need to have the processes to make sure that it doesn't go in the other businesses.
And is it your recollection again that this was probably Mr. Bushnell saying this as well?
Yeah, I think generically, and I you know, this is several years ago now,
right.
I think Dave talked through the whole thing,
okay.
And others added comments.
Okay. One of the general observations we've heard from folks a lot more knowledgeable about Citigroup than I am is that it is sort of more siloed in its business structure than other large financial organizations, and that the lack or quantity of communication between the silos at Citigroup is less than the amount of communication across business units at other commercial organizations, large financial institutions. Do you have any basis for judging whether or not that's true, that the level at Citigroup is less than it is at other large financial institutions, the level of communication?
What time frame are you talking?
Well, Citigroup back then, let's say 2006, 2007, and other institutions now or in your past or of which you were contemporaneously aware of.
Yeah, Bart, I don't know that I can really, I don't think I have a basis to make a comparison on that. We looked at management committees and how the bank interacted, but and various committees and structures that it had. But I don't have a basis to say whether Citi was more or less than the other. I mean, to be elusive, but I don't.
Okay. That's fine. Let's turn to page 11. In the box, support for conduits, SIVs, SPEs. Let's start first with a general question. What do you know about the SIVs that were, as I understand it, operated out of London? What can you tell me is your knowledge about those SIVs?
I have fairly general knowledge in that it was a business managed out of Howick in London.
And what is COIC?
COIC, Citibank Overseas Investment Corp. It's the Red Cake sub out there. And that was the primary vehicle for those, or the vehicle, as I understand it. So there was a series of SIVs out there, five or six. I don't know the actual number. That I did see some asset reports on the SIVs as they wound up getting into trouble. And you know, it was interesting at that point in time that as I looked at the asset quality of the SIVs, I thought it was pretty high. But there was a lot of it was financial, highly regarded financial institutions. And as the market began to get more and more nervous, it didn't matter what was in there. It was the fact that it was a SIV. So the bank had these, and they were intent on keeping them masters of their own destiny off the balance sheet. That was their goal the entire time. They thought that they were professionals who bought into them. They should be able to understand the risks and manage them.
When you say they, are you talking about Citigroup or Citibank?
This would be it would be a Citibank sub under COIC. So, but it's group management who's doing it. So, not much on the details. I'm sorry.
That's fine. So reading that first paragraph, Citigroup does not intend to consolidate its SIVs. As management stated, the SIVs are the masters of their own destiny. Any support will be viewed from an economic interest perspective. Citigroup will offer the same as any other third party. Citigroup provides partial liquidity support. Close quote. So I guess at that time, at this meeting, it was the view of at least Mr. Bushnell and Mr. Rubin and Mr. Helfer that Citi did not intend to consolidate its SIVs and they were going to treat them as independent third parties.
Correct. Did you talk to John about Lyons about this? This one?
I don't believe we did. I don't think he...
Okay. Yeah, because the ultimate decision to consolidate happened on his term. Based on my conversation with John, the bank was very firm up until like the day before. We're not going to do it, and then they did it. And based on my understanding is that the bank got pressure from the investors who basically said, if you don't support this, we're not going to provide any business on the other side of the bank.
We heard that.
That's anecdotal from me.
Right.
That's not directly to me.
Right. So we've heard similar things with respect to the liquidity puts and the asset-backed commercial paper that situation that erupted, I guess, in August 2007. Based on our conversation with Mr. Frake, that it was his understanding the bank did not have a legal obligation under the liquidity puts to provide more than temporary support during the commercial paper disruption, but that Citigroup, Citibank, voluntarily decided to buy the commercial paper because of client demands that I think were the same sort of demands that if we end up being stuck with this, we're going to eliminate our other business with Citibank. Were you aware of that? Had that ever been communicated to you, that those sort of statements were made with respect to the asset-backed commercial paper as well?
I'm glad you got that from Ron, because he was much more intimate with that. And so the actual details of that, I don't recall specifically what the terms of the put
right.
options really were
right.
and how much latitude the bank had with respect to doing it. So I'm not sure on that.
So you don't, if I said, did Vanguard Mutual Fund call up Citi and say, if we eat these asset-backed commercial paper losses, we're going to pull all our other related business with Citigroup and Citibank? You don't know?
I don't. No, I don't know personally.
Okay.
Yeah, those were conversations after me.
Yeah, I think we're getting to that point in the document trail. Let's go to the last page. Remarks by Chairman of the Board, Robert Rubin. I'm going to take a minute to read this, so if you want to take a minute, go ahead. So is it your recollection that sort of Mr. Bushnell spoke for most of the meeting, as you said, there was back and forth of questions and input from others. But then Mr. Rubin sort of summed things up at the end. Is that why this is at the end of the document? No, the other way around?
Rubin opened it.
Rubin introduced it?
Made a couple of statements and got up and left.
Got up and left?
Yeah.
Oh. So he, how long was he there?
10-15 minutes.
10-15 minutes.
Important clarification when I said who was there. Apologies.
No, that's okay. So is the statement in the first sentence attributed to him, as financial engineering became more complex, it exacerbated rather than reduced volatility. Do you agree with that?
Because I don't know that all the complex financial engineering resulted in the issues. You know, so that's a big statement, meaning that we shouldn't have financial engineering because it created volatility. I think that the volatility results from a lot of different things. I think what financial engineering may have done would be to make it more difficult to identify where there are pockets of risk. May have made it more difficult to identify the tail events. But I don't know that by its nature, financial engineering increased volatility in the market. It created challenges in risk management in making sure you know it. But that it, would it increase volatility? I don't know.
So when you say more difficult to identify, more opaque, it's harder to...
When you have risk that's modeled, as opposed to an FX contract. If you have a risk that... standard option. You've got the five elements or whatever it is that goes into an option pricing model. One of them is volatility. And you put it in a model, it comes out with a price. That's a little bit more hard to understand than it would be on how much is the price of the British pound right now. So as you move down, as the engineering gets more complex, as products are modeled more, it does become a little bit more difficult, challenging to make sure you've got all those risks properly dimensioned. But does that create volatility? I don't know. See, I'm not smart enough to know that.
Uh-huh. I'm not either. I just get asked questions. I don't have to answer any. So, I believe it was Mr. Lyons who commented that one of the problems or one of the challenges related to the super senior AAA CDOs was, in fact, that everything was based on modeling and there were no independent arm's length sales, and so the valuation is always being driven by the models, and there's no extrinsic evidence to say, is this reasonable? Do you think that sort of the lack of any actual market for these kind of complex instruments exacerbates price risk?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure.
Well, price risk is one of your metrics, right?
Right.
Price risk, moderate, high, low. If you have a CDO product, super senior AAA, the fact that, as opposed to, say, a AAA bond issued by Merck, which may not trade all the time, but does trade.
Okay.
Is the fact that you're relying exclusively on models instead of having any trading input. Does that indicate that there is more price risk in your boxes?
Yes. Yes. The lack of active market, transparent prices, the lack of that would increase price risk. Got it.
So I think your statements earlier were that roughly the fourth quarter of 07 was the end of your transition period. Were there any of the communications in 08, the very high-level communications made to Citigroup or made from Citigroup to the OCC ever brought to your attention? Or in 08, were you just completely out of the room?
I was fully engaged in this work.
So just to go over one document, which is Frank 27.
Right.
It's a March 24th letter to John Lyons, which I understand is a cover letter with many exhibits attached to it, responding to the examination report. Did anyone, have you seen this document before?
Last night over a burger.
So as you were munching on your burger and you turned to page 11 and saw that for the first time, did it give you a little indigestion? I mean...
Response?
Well, let's be a little more precise in the question, I think, since he said he's only seen this document within the last 24 hours.
Sure.
You're basically asking him, does he agree or disagree with the statement in there based on what? Events in 2008 or prior years?
Well, his only view is going to be based on reading it last night and seeing it today. So reading it last night for the first time, I assume you got to the section titled Unfairness in the OCC's Approach.
Yep.
Tell me, one, what you think of the tone of this letter compared to the tone of the November 17th meeting we just talked to?
The tone
of the letter. The letter speaks for itself.
Right.
He can answer the question.
Well, you can compare the tone of the two documents.
What? I'd like to know what he thinks.
All right. Since he hasn't seen the document, let's be clear that the document is a document in many parts. And I think it'd be fairer, Bart, if you ask him to talk about a particular part and what he regards the tone of that part is, and then compare it to what he recalls about that meeting in 2007.
Fair enough. I'm asking about the part that begins on page 11. It's titled Unfairness in the OCC's Approach. Which I assume you had a chance to read or skim last night. What is your assessment of the tone of that section of the letter?
I think... my first thought is that as I read it, I could hear Michael Helfer the whole way through. But I think it's a little defensive. And I think it's trying to add perspective to what the comments were. And I think they're trying to indicate that Citi was not the only financial institution to be clobbered by the financial meltdown. In particular, on CDOs, and what have examples of quotes and other things, and regulatory comments from various folks. So I think it was defensive.
Now, was the tone in that November meeting we just talked about, was the tone in that meeting defensive, or was the tone in that meeting more open?
The November
meeting,
the SSG meeting.
Yes, the meeting.
November 2007.
Yes.
Right. I thought that meeting, the November meeting, was just matter of fact, not defensive.
So you would say there was a difference between the tone of that meeting and the tone of this section of that this letter?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. As I said at the beginning, we're going to do a little time traveling just okay. to keep my own documents sort of under control.
Sure.
So we're going back. What do we want to mark these? 20, where are we at? 29?
We haven't marked any new ones today.
So we haven't?
Okay. Have we? I'm asking.
Yeah, no, we have. Hang on.
We have one. There's Waterhouse 29.
Yeah, we did check
for
this letter.
We're up to 30.
Okay.
You said you're up to 30?
So 30.
This is 30. This is 30?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. There were because there were two documents attached to each other.
Right.
So that's right.
This will be 30.
So this is a letter dated February 19th, 2003. It's not signed, but the signatories would be Eugene Jacoby and Homer Hill.
Right.
And it's addressed to Mr. Bushnell and Mr. Garnett, and it's dated February 19th, 2003.
Right.
Do you know if you've ever seen this document before?
As I mentioned before, I would have seen anything that went to the bank, so this should have come through me.
And so this was in that time frame when the earlier model of having the
right.
examiners sign right. stuff before they changed.
Scott, your answer is that you would have seen it. Do you specifically remember seeing it?
I don't. You know, just on first glance, I don't specifically remember seeing this one.
Why don't you take time to read the first paragraph?
First paragraph or the first bullet?
First paragraph.
Okay.
On page one.
On page one. So, as I understand this letter, it involves a joint review or a joint examination by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and DOCC?
Correct.
Tell me how joint examinations in general are conducted, if you can.
Sure. They take different forms. We will many times have examinations where the Fed will participate on our review. We have the pen, we have the control, we define the scope, but they need to find interest or find out what's going on. Likewise, we'll do participate on Fed reviews if we if they let us in and if we have interest. So where there is need or where it's appropriate, we will do joint exams. And where I say appropriate, a part of the reason issues that would be appropriate would be those issues that cut across the enterprise, okay, like audit or compliance or risk interest rate risk management. So those are the types of things that we would typically Basel now. That we typically do a joint examination. So, in this case, market risk management, joint exam, and I'm speculating now, the reason why we would have done a joint exam is because we probably were looking at stuff in the bank and not in the bank. So the Fed was probably participating for that reason. And depending on the exam and where the motivation comes from, which agency, the scope and objectives will typically be defined and by one agency and then agreed with the other or amended with the other, so we come up with a common scope.
So this exam was of the GCIB, the Global Corporate and Investment Bank.
Correct.
So is it my understanding that, or frankly, is it your understanding that this entity straddled the legal entity of Citibank, and there were some parts of that that were inside the legal entity of Citibank and some parts that were outside?
This GCIB, the CIB is now something else.
Right.
But yeah, there are a number of different legal entities that report into that.
And do you know what the purpose of this exam was at the time? Having reread that paragraph, does it refresh your recollection of what was happening in 2003?
No, it doesn't refresh my recollection, but what this would probably be an examination that we would have had scheduled to go into and test the risk management and the level of risk in these businesses. So the scope included an overview of business activities. So I think this would be a standard exam.
Okay. So what is market risk management? Explain that to me.
Market risk management, as I recall from them, would have been independent risk management.
So that, putting it in current terms, and I don't know if he was, well, I guess he is David Bushnell. So that was Mr. Bushnell's role, independent risk management, at a later point, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, here he appears to be head of risk management for GCIB, and later he becomes risk management for...
Correct.
Citigroup.
Correct. And it is, and both these guys are independent, so yeah, that I was just a little nervous about making that statement on the MRM, but yeah. So Dave was the head of the GCIB. Garnett is the head of risk architecture, as today. And we, on a separate note, the former senior risk officer, a guy named Petros Spatakakis.
How do you spell the last name?
It's Greek, and it's every syllable, Sabatacakas, I think, something like that. Petros.
Something like that. Okay.
He was the senior risk officer before Bushnell. And,
okay.
We had, way back at this time frame, we had concerns about Petros, and I had a number of discussions, even, a meeting with the president of Citibank to talk about the level and stature of risk management. So ultimately, Dave wound up in that role. But yes, he was down at the GCIB at this time.
Okay. So in the third sentence, the scope of the examination included a review of key responsibilities, including limit setting and monitoring. And that's just part of the sentence.
Right.
Would that include the sort of limits we've talked about before, the some sort of aggregate limit on exposure to particular products at particular desks? Is that what limit setting means?
Yes, it would be. There's probably a VAR limit, and there's also what they had factor sensitivity limits that would go through each risk factor, and there would be limits on those. So they would have looked at the processes. Based on this, they would have looked into how they derived those limits.
And VAR means valuation at risk?
Value at risk.
Value at risk. So let's turn to page 4. And at the bottom it has the heading Capital Markets Approval Committee.
Right.
I'd just like to note for the record that on page 4 there is a highlighted sentence on the document, which we didn't put there.
No, I was going to get to that. So I've highlighted a sentence for you on page 4, actually two, I think. It says, in London, we reviewed the procedures and database system for administration of the Capital Markets Approval Committee process for Europe. This process is clearly at a level of best practices and is recommended for other CMAC processes globally. Can you tell me what that means?
Not other than what it would say, that as they looked at it, apparently the vetting process through the CMAC in London was better than in other places around the world.
And when it says we in a document like this, I assume that means the OCC as well as the Fed?
Correct. Did morph over time, as we talked about, based on the formal agreement.
Right.
Its responsibilities became greater.
So the next document is actually two documents I'd like you to take a look at. Again, as I understand it, this sort of follows the general framework you've described where a cover letter is sent to someone at Citibank or Citigroup, and the conclusion memo is behind it. Document number 31 is a letter dated January 31st, 2005 to David Bushnell, and it's from Alfred Crumlish. Mm-hmm. And it regards Citigroup risk management. As you look at this today, do you have any recollection of this document?
Yeah. Like any document 5 years ago, seen again for the first time, I do have a vague recollection of this one, yes.
Okay. So let's go to the second document, 32. Mm-hmm. And this is a January 13th, 2005 memorandum from John Fleming to Alfred Crumlish. Would this have been brought to your attention back in 2005 as the EIC?
Yeah.
Looking at it today, do you have any recollection?
Yeah.
So I've highlighted a couple clauses in the first page, second sentence. Senior risk executives were interviewed in various top-level information materials, including board reports, policy, and training resources were read and analyzed. And then conclusions, CRM provides satisfactory oversight of credit and market risks. So those are sort of the statement of the broad process and the broad mm-hmm. conclusion. Mm-hmm. And then if you turn to page 3, I've highlighted the last two sentences in the final paragraph. Finally, it is essential that risk management become more firmly embedded in the culture of Citigroup. Earnings and profitability growth have taken precedence over risk management and internal control. So, explain to me what message you think this document was sending to Mr. Bushnell at Citigroup regarding the OCC's level of concern with its risk management practices.
This was similar to our earlier discussion in that we were not seeing evidence of firm challenge from independent risk management throughout the business. And that we were looking for him to, and I don't know if you have the response to this, but looking for him to recognize, it's really to recognize the importance of independent risk management in supervising and overseeing the risk control functions or the risk-taking activities.
I'll jump ahead and give you what I'll mark as 33, which I believe is the response from Mr. Bushnell to Mr. Crumlish.
Just from my notes, what's the date of the response?
The date is March 14, 2005.
So I'll give you my observation, and then you can tell me what you think of my observation. When I read this document, I have the same sort of observation as when I read Mr. Frake's work, is that the examiners basically spotted fairly early on some of the core problems that would come home to roost later. And if you look at this, these last two sentences. It is essential that risk management become more firmly embedded in the culture of Citigroup, and earnings and profitability growth have taken precedence over risk management and internal control. But that, to me, is sort of the core message of this document. Yet, on the conclusion, it says it provides satisfactory oversight. So when I read it, as someone who's not intimately involved in the process, I see sort of a mixed message being sent. Because I do think, both here and when they looked at the price risk on the CDOs, that they saw sort of the beginnings, you know, the warm embers that would eventually boil into a conflagration and cause the problem.
Right.
But when you look at a document like this, to me it sends a mixed message. It says, yes, there are some issues, but what you're doing is satisfactory.
Right.
So if I'm wrong, tell me why I'm wrong, and explain to me what you think this does.
Yeah, I think much of the kind, and I know John Fleming very well, and I know much of what he was emphasizing was the need to look across the silos to be able to aggregate the risks. So we had been working with management to try to better provide information that way, and I think they talk about the real estate exposure as they were trying to do it, and I don't know how they characterize that, but that was an arduous struggle for the bank to pull that together. So this is kind of thematically along with the need to improve enterprise-wide risk management and improve the ability of the bank to look at risk across the silos. So that's one message. Having said that, as we do exams, if you go down a level or two, do exams at the desk, do interest rate derivatives or foreign exchange, just to pull those two again. So you look at risks at those levels. They were managed fine. They were okay. We never had issues with those types of things. We had miscellaneous other ones. But where the bank is not good, even today, is it aggregating the risks across the enterprise.
So do you agree with my assessment that a memo like this sends a mixed message, or is that, do you believe that's inaccurate?
I think it's a message that we had consistently been talking to management with all along. So I think it depends on how much emphasis you want to get on that risk aggregation, where we would see risk at lower levels, at desk levels and whatever else, being appropriately managed. It was more of that bigger level. And I kind of viewed that as a longer-term project, because you know, it's one of those things that the bank is constantly working on, trying to get better information across the system. And I don't know that they'll ever be able to get there, frankly, but It is, you know, it is a big, big task for them to go.
Okay, I'll try one more time.
Okay.
Do you think this letter and this memo was a message to Mr. Bushnell that there were significant problems or minor problems at the risk management level with Citigroup and Citibank?
The message here is that risk management, as we said, was satisfactory, right? But that they need to continue to enhance, need to build out the broader infrastructure. I think that's the message.
And would you characterize that as a minor problem or a significant problem?
At this time, I was characterizing it as it was not a significant problem at this point in time.
Okay.
Which was January 2005.
Okay. So now let's go to the response, okay. Number 33. And this is the letter dated March 14, 2005. So the first bullet point is a quote from the document we've just been talking to.
Right.
Risk management in business lines, legal vehicles, countries, and regions should broaden their perspective beyond individual risk silos, e.g. credit market and operational risk, by assessing linkages among the various risk types. Mm-hmm. And then the response, which I've highlighted, says CRM agrees that our scope and reporting should be further expanded to include not only the vertical approach, but also the horizontal assessment of market, credit, and operational risks. Mm-hmm. And if you go on to the next page, the next sentence, skipping a sentence, I've highlighted, says, to date, reviews of our real estate exposure, as well as ongoing risk forums for individuals covering real estate, have allowed us to look across silos. Do you think that that was an accurate statement?
Which statement?
The last sentence I read to you.
To date.
Our review of real estate exposure as well as ongoing risk forms for individuals covering real estate have allowed us to look across silos.
That is not an inaccurate statement. Say that because, okay. Yes, as they pulled it, it allowed them to look across silos. The bigger question is how effective was it? How much information came out of it? Did it tell them anything? Did it cause them to act? This just says that it allowed them to do it.
So your assessment would be that it's an accurate statement because they were looking across silos, but your more nuanced view is they weren't effectively looking across silos.
I wouldn't go that far yet. What I would do, going back to my understanding, is the proof of the pudding's in the eating. We'd have to go see it. We'd have to test it and understand it. But this is, yeah, that's an accurate statement as far as it goes. So, and it is a very difficult thing to do. And in a short amount of time at a bank like Citibank, I don't know that they could actually provide a meaningful thing, although this was a year-long project, if I remember, trying to pull that together.
I clarify one thing. What do you understand the reference to real estate in the sentence to be?
This is a project run by John Ingram at the bank where he was trying to identify all real estate holdings across the company, because he had a number of different businesses and systems. So what he was trying to pull that all together and see what the exposure was in aggregate.
In the bank or in the group?
This was group-wide. And the question is, I don't know if that would include the CDO super seniors. I don't know that that would include that, because I do know that the bank never considered those things. The super seniors never considered them subprime.
because they were super senior structured into AAA Access Plus.
Did they consider them real estate exposures?
I don't, yeah, that comes back to this. I don't know if, like, for the purposes of this, whether they scoop those in.
Yeah. All right, now we're going to get on to a group of documents dealing with a separate tangential issue. And I'll mark the first one, 34. The 34 is a letter dated October 21st, 2005. From Mr. Guy Whitaker to you, involving Citibank Nevada NA.
Right.
Are you familiar with this document?
Yes.
Have you recently reviewed this document?
Yes.
Okay, so we don't have to go all over it again. Let's go to Document 35. 35 is a letter from you dated October 26th, 2005 to Mr. Guy Whitaker, the treasurer at Citigroup, Inc. And just to complete the arc, let's go to Document 37.
I'm going to skip 36.
Oops.
Okay.
Let me fix that.
He's a good examiner. He's on the ball.
Yeah, I majored in accounting, too. Boy. 36 is a letter, again, from Mr. Whitaker to you, dated November 4th, 2005. So first of all, let me just step back and have you describe to me the events surrounding these three letters.
Okay. I vaguely remember the phone calls, but the letters help. I would have got a call as the bank was preparing its call report. And you now know that this is Citibank Nevada, $16 billion credit card bank, right?
Right.
This is not Citibank NA.
This is pre, yes.
So this is one of the subsidiaries. They have to prepare call reports for a number of different entities. So I got the call that said that based on, they would forecast out what asset growth, credit card receivables, securitizations, and all that. They would forecast out what they expected asset levels to be and would calculate a capital level to support that. What Citigroup does is have its subsidiaries dividend up excess profits into a pool, and they manage their money centrally. Right? So at any rate, at this point, the bank, sometime in August, dividended up $2.1 billion from the credit card bank into Citigroup. As they went about going preparing their call report, they found out that at this point in time, they thought that they had made a mistake, dividended too much, and that their total capital ratio would fall below well-capitalized levels, below 10%. So Guy called me to tell me that this had happened and that they'd already put $550 million back into Citibank Nevada. Okay. So at any rate, I got that, ultimately got this letter here. So I called Grace, my boss, said, okay, what do we do with this? So Grace went to legal, and she said, actually went to special supervision, I think, to start with, because special supervision is the one that deals with this, but then ultimately legal, and said, what do we do with this?
And do you know who she would have talked to in special supervision and legal?
In legal, it was Brian McCormally, ultimately, who was...
Brian McCormick is my predecessor, Director of Enforcement, Special Supervision.
And somebody, Sam.
That was Sam Rosak, staff lawyer.
He drafted the
legal. Yeah. And Special Supervision, it probably was John Quill.
I think Grace said it was John. It was Ron Schneck.
Excuse me, Deputy Director Ron Schneck.
How do you spell
S-C-H-N-E-C-K.
Okay.
Thank you.
So anyway, we had Grace and I had you know, some conversations, some emails, and it turned out that we collectively, the OCC, determined that you know, under Part 6 we needed to respond to the bank's letter. So we drafted a letter, which is item 35, drafted the letter in response to the bank's response. And, you know, this is drafted and legal. We went back and forth and wound up with this language. So basically what we did is we sent this note to Guy that said that we understand you made a mistake. And notwithstanding the fact that your total capital ratios as of the end of September are below well capitalized, because you've, in essence, because you've already dividended and made the bank whole, we will consider you well capitalized, and you, any of the punitive aspects of the prompt corrective action won't apply. So this is not a retroactive approval of the capital. It is an acknowledgement that they made a mistake, that the September 30th numbers were incorrect. We didn't tell them to go back and change it. We just said we recognize as of October 26th, you put the money back in, and you are above the well-capitalized levels, so we will consider you well-capitalized.
So were you considering them well-capitalized as of September 30th, 2005?
Well, I didn't know. Remember, it takes, the call report takes, you know, they have to 30 days to do it, and it wasn't, I was just about 21 days in as they're starting crunching the numbers. I would have assumed that they would have been well-capitalized as of 1231, but they made a mistake. The numbers came out wrong, and the numbers are what they are.
I understand that, but let me point you to the sentence in the last paragraph.
Right.
Notwithstanding the initial transaction that impacted the total capital ratios as of the September 30th, 2005 call report date, we still consider the bank to be well capitalized for the purposes of 12 CFR Part 6. So my question is, were you considering them to be well capitalized as of the date of this letter, October 26th, 2005, or were you considering them to be well capitalized as of September 30th, 2005?
It would be as of the date of the letter, because they filed a call report that had a capital number that was below well capitalized. And it is what that is what it is. So I can't say that you were well capitalized then, because they weren't. And that's not the intent of this letter. The intent of this letter is to say, you blew it. You put the money back in, and even though those numbers are wrong, or not wrong, but even though those numbers show that you're below 10%, we'll still consider you for PCA to be well capitalized as of this date. I don't. You know, we could have said that more clearly. But that was definitely the intent.
As of the date, October 26, 2005.
Correct.
So are there other drafts of this letter that are still in existence? Do you have any knowledge?
I don't know.
Yes, they are.
There are?
Okay. And I believe they've been produced to you with this set. Have documents, but we can double check. But I believe they were included in the same production.
Other drafts of this letter, of number 35, October 26, 2000.
Yes, yes.
Different versions.
There were earlier. What happened was the letter was drafted and it was sent to legal to review, and legal added in, I believe,
sites.
The 12 CFR 6.4B.
Yeah, I think we drafted, the supervision drafted the original letter, if I recall, and sent it in and said, you know, we're not lawyers, but what do you think of this?
Right.
And they put in the legal cites.
And you think we have the other version?
I believe so. I checked. I'm getting a concerned look from Erica. I believe they're in the production, but we'll double check.
Okay. Because I mean, there's a lot of stuff there, but I've gone, yeah. The way I found this was I went page through page
right.
of everything, and I don't recall seeing draft. I only recall seeing the final version. But
yeah.
My recollection may not be accurate.
It was in the set of documents, which included Exhibit 35 and Exhibit 34, 35, and 36.
Let me
we'll double check.
This. It's our intent to make sure you have every document related to this issue.
Okay.
So we're putting together a packet of everything, which includes some emails and so forth. We'll get that to you as soon as we can. If we can locate by Bates number some of those documents as
you
already
can just
produced,
reference them
we'll
as
reference those to you.
That,
as well.
That's fine.
Because there are, as you know, there are, you've marked one of them, there are some other documents related to this issue.
Right. So the as long as we're just clearing up, the one other thing I would like to get is
the
unamended call report, because I've been able to find the amended call reports for Citibank, and not in your production, I just went on the website.
I actually have the amended. By that,
you
mean
the
November
amended.
One.
You want the unamended.
I want the unamended.
You want the original.
I want the original.
That we have tried to find, and Grace tells me it's not possible to get it.
Well, if it's not possible, it's not possible, but if it is, we'd certainly like to see it happen.
You know, we're going to see if we have it. The problem is that, you know, they're filed electronically, and when there's an amendment, it supersedes the prior. So if it wasn't printed out at that time,
yeah, because
and maybe it's obtainable from the bank, but you know we're checking to see if it was printed out and we have it.
Yeah, we had tried, and we're putting together a narrative to respond to your question, and we tried to locate the original call report filed as of 9/30/05, but all that we can locate is the amended one, which was filed on November the 1st.
Well, what I'm saying is we're still looking, and we will see if we can locate it for you.
Fair enough. Fair
enough. The other document there. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just making sure that I'm going to honor my commitment.
No, I'm fine. I'm fine. The other document is on the 4th.
Talking about Exhibit
36. Exhibit
36. It's where they then discovered that there was a...
They didn't make a mistake.
Well, they made two mistakes.
Yeah.
Right?
So that they were well-capitalized the entire time. They just made a mistake. The interesting thing is that year-end 2005, Citibank Nevada had the $500 million extra capital in there, and their capital numbers went through the roof at year-end because they were... They were like 12 and 17 or 12 and 18 at that time. But this is not a retroactive capital approval.
Are you aware of any instances where the OCC has ever given retroactive capital
approval? Let me tell you what I know, because I figure you might ask this. I do not ever recall anything like this at Citi in my time. Never. And I asked Grace the same question. She can answer that. But she, in the 5 years prior to me, she could not recall ever having anything like this. So speaking
when
from
you
my...
You say like this, do you mean a mistake?
A mistake that comes to...
That would affect the well-capitalized status of the
yep,
bank?
Yeah, that's... I'm sorry. Thanks, Rick. That's exactly what I mean. I've never.
Well,
never.
Can I ask a question? During your tenure, during Grace's tenure, did the bank ever fall below well-capitalized,
no.
to your knowledge?
No. No. They never did. I thought we did a good job on this, frankly. Because, you know, we had supervision, legal, we evaluated, you know, and we went back. We didn't do retroactive approval. But hopefully, when it provides the documentation, you agree.
And do you know if Grace communicated this to anyone else? Would you know?
What do you mean, anyone else?
Well, besides the folks you've mentioned in supervision and legal, would she have communicated it to anybody else?
Within OCC?
Yes.
I don't know. We have emails that we're going to supply, and
okay.
You'll be able to see copies on whoever was on the email, but beyond that, I don't know. She had hallway conversations or anything else, I don't know.
Okay.
And a few questions, did she have conversations up the chain?
Yes.
I don't know. We can ask her.
Okay.
All right. She had mentioned to us that she did.
So, we're actually going to get out of her. Before we conclude the interview, I'd like to give you a chance to address anything that you felt I've left out about what's important to Citibank and Citigroup, even though it's not within your legal jurisdiction. You obviously have knowledge to some degree of the events that led to their problems.
I've got three lawyers here who will probably tell me to shut up, but I would like to say a few things, if that's all right. One is on that last line of questioning that we just had about what message are we sending to management on that. As I think about the issue there, we're trying to get management to draw together risk reports that cross the bank, across the enterprise. And I think that's important, and they need to be better at that. But I do not think, when I think about what has impacted the bank and Citigroup in 2007 and 2008, if they had pristine reports here, I don't think that would have mattered at all. I think that the issues that would have happened in 2007 and 2008 would have happened no matter what. And and I think about two major things on that. One is, and it's in that SSG document. Dave Bushnell talked about leverage lending and CDOs. In both instances, the bank made the conscious decision to expand those businesses. They thought about it, they analyzed it, they thought they knew the business, and they decided to move forward with it. Back to the question on enterprise risk management, they knew that, they focused on it, they did it. So that wouldn't have helped in that regard. From a risk management point of view. Second thing is they get into leverage lending. We spend a lot of time on CDOs, but leverage lending is a big deal at this company, and it's a big risk. So I don't want to forget about that. The group managed its leverage lending, basically its lending risk, mainly out of a company called CNAI, Citibank, Citigroup, Citicorp, I don't know, North America Inc., CNAI. That is a non-bank subsidiary used for funding for their loan underwriting. I am told by my credit folks that about 80% of the credits originated by the bank go through CNAI. That is a rough estimate because it is deal by deal, right? Sometimes more, sometimes less. But approximately 80% of them go through CNAI. In John Lyon's letter to Vikram, that was unfair, they say, he talks about leverage lending limits. In 2006, the limits went from 35 to 50 billion. In March of 2007, they went from 50 to 100 billion. We're informed. We have quarterly reports with risk management where we talk about what's going on, what's changed in underwriting, what's changed in limits. So I don't know if we knew that immediately in March when they did it or if it would have been at some point we would have been informed. But the bank decided to step on the gas in the leveraged loan area in 2007. Okay, that's important. Now, at the same time, or as this was going, and it's in the documents, Bushnell mentioned that the bank wound up approving five or six of the big mega deals during this time frame in 2007. Okay. So these things start working through the pipeline, this $100 billion pipeline. They start working their way through it, heading towards funding. And in mid-2007, the market crashes. So CNAI doesn't have the capital, doesn't have the liquidity. I don't know if about its reserves, but it doesn't have the wherewithal to fund these things, and nobody's going to buy them. This originate to distribute thing is not working. So one of the reasons why the bank uses CNAI is to stay within the anti-tying restrictions,
right.
So they use a non-bank sub so they can tie them up. So at any rate, bank management had this big slug of credits going through the pipeline that CNAI couldn't fund. So what do you do with it? So those things wind up getting funded and slammed into the bank. Our guys looked to see if there's any 23A, 23B issues, if there's any tie-in issues to try to keep those things out, but there was nothing at that point. So the question is, those wound up in the bank in mid-2007 or whatever, I don't know exactly when this is. And they want to take the losses on those. Those are big losses. CNAI was a bit frustrating for me because it was a non-bank sub. It was supervised by the Fed. It was out of our jurisdiction. And we had seen squirrely loans going through CNAI over the years. I had mentioned this to my CPC counterpart. You need to look at this. I handed her files on it. So this thing continued. So in essence here, and I know we're talking a little bit about boundary issues, but this process that CNAI would have this big limit, that they would use that limit, get stuck, and then they would jam them in the bank, and we weren't able to do anything about it, is a big frustration. So I don't know if Fed has reports on CNAI of 2005 or 2006. It'd be interesting to see what they might have said, or if they had it in 2007, what they thought about capital liquidity and reserves. But that, to me, is a very frustrating thing. So consequently, the bank has now taken losses on leveraged lending that it shouldn't have. Because over time, those things that were good quality assets, not 23 and 80 or B issues, turned out to be. That's frustrating. The CDO business is managed outside the bank. It is, according to Bushnell and John Lyons, it changed from an agency business to a principal business. They wound up holding more.
Right.
We don't know that. That's outside of our jurisdiction. We cannot. Graham Leach Bailey would not let us go look at that. Yet the bank had these puts that were not reported in any risk system that we had. We didn't know about them. And ultimately, these puts originated in 2003, 2004. So this is not new risk to Citibank.
Right.
So you say, what happened in 2007? This happened before that. What happened in 2007 is that the same market that crashed on leveraged lending crashed on the CP conduits, and nobody would fund that. The bank bought some, then ultimately they exercised their puts. So there. So that's not new risk. That was a manifestation of existing risk. So that was part of the 2000. As I think about what happened in 2007, these things, these events, some of them were pre-baked, some of them were part of the bank's specific strategy to be the number one player in these businesses, ramp it up, and some of it was clearly outside of our ability to influence the risk taking. But it wound up on the bank's books. So that's why, back to my earlier comment, I thought our 2006 report was good, because a lot of stuff happened after the end of 2006 that they ramped up risk, it was out of our jurisdiction, and it wound up being slammed in the bank. The CDO business ramped it. It doubled its own limits, 10 to 20 billion or whatever it was, and the business risk changed. And then that wound up, part of the risk wound up in the bank as well. So there's a lot of things that happened. Then we have the thrift with its loan losses coming through that actually originate on that. So I think, and go back to my for their comment. I think the OCC, I'm actually proud of what we did there. I think the guys did a good job. I think they did the best they could. We identified risks and issues. We raised them. We used the MRAs to get a corrective action. But we're the bank. There's things that happen outside the bank. So it's a big task, but I think our guys did pretty well. The bank, as you look at earnings over the years, the bank, they made lots of money. And then 2008, they lost $6 billion. Citibank lost $6 billion, and then $3
billion. $6 billion in?
2008, $3 billion in 2009.
Oh, okay.
So $9 billion over the 2 years, Citibank.
Right.
Citibank could survive that, even with all that stuff being jammed in there. Citibank would... the manager called it the crown jewel, but we were very protective of the bank, and doggone it, I think we tried our best. I think we did a good job, and there are some impediments out there that are hard to get around. And when bank management increases risk at a legal entity outside of our jurisdiction and then jams it in there, there's not a lot we can do about that.
So. If you're king for the day and you get to write the rules for financial regulation and supervision of large institutions, is there one consolidated regulator that has supervision, examination, and regulatory authority over an entire beast like Citibank?
Yeah. You need it. I think it depends on most of the risks that are in there and the consolidation of those risks. You either need to be able to seal it off, but if there's going to be risks that are influencing the bank, impacting the bank, and this is just my opinion,
right?
And I'm nobody.
Well, in my hypothetical, you're king for the day.
But it's not. It doesn't make sense that Citibank N.A. would be taking losses for risks that were not originated by it, its management, but were jammed in there later on. So, and that regulator would be us.
I understand that as well.
I honestly, Bart, the OCC does a good job. You'll have your conclusions, and I'm sure we'll get our. We've remained focused on the bank. We've done our supervision. We've communicated well with the bank. We're consistent. We're methodical. And we do our job. And I'm proud of what we do. So I'm not sure that's what you're bargaining for at the as far as a final comment. But
No, it's your forum. I think you should be able to express your beliefs and feelings. And,
okay.
And I have to say, in all experience with examiners at the OCC, I've always found people of the very highest quality. So I have no beef with you there.
Right. Will you be interviewing the other regulators on Citi?
I will be talking with the Federal Reserve, but not all of the interviews will be ones I'm attending. We have different teams, and I sort of hop in and hop out, but I have made it a point to insert myself into the questioning at the senior level and hopefully at the Reserve Bank level, at the Federal Reserve, and obviously I'm going to cover some of the issues you've raised as well as some of the issues that we have on our own as well. And it's 10 minutes to 1, I am happy to say we're getting out before I said we would, and so we are concluding this interview.